Right, the web stream is live.
Okay. The time is 9 o'clock in the morning. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the second day of the 96th public meeting of the D.A. Buchanan Independent Safety Committee. The first item on our agenda today is for committee members' comments. Dr. Per Peterson, the podium is yours.
Thank you, Dr. Lamb. I do have some comments, and I'd like us to return a little bit and have some discussion related to the set of presentations that we had yesterday evening on spent fuel management, and in particular, the study of the risks of some of the different offloading scenarios associated with the interim storage of the spent fuel that will be taken out from the spent fuel pools at Diablo Canyon. I think that there's an important point that is validated through this study, which is that the risks associated with the different scenarios are very small. That is, you really have to look at extremely rare or infrequent types of events in order to see any differences between these different scenarios. And so in this case, the overall impact on safety from selecting between these scenarios is really small. At least in my judgment, I think that means that it is quite reasonable and appropriate for other criteria to enter into the decision besides safety, because the differences in safety are literally quite small. In things such as how much the California ratepayers will pay for decommissioning would be a reasonable thing to be considered in making that decision. And so if one of the scenarios results in, let's say, lower decommissioning costs for the plants, and that might be one that allows one to remove all of the spent fuel from the pools earlier, If that one results in lower cost, I think that it would be appropriate for that to be weighed heavily in the decision, given that the safe differences in safety between the different approaches have been shown pretty rigorously to be very, very small. Now, as a percentage basis, of course, these differences are quantitatively, noticeable. 40% between two small numbers is a noticeable difference.
Yeah, but a dime is twice a nickel.
I understand that, and so for that reason, what I'd like to do is to I think we do need as a committee to speak to the significance of this of these differences in the level of safety between these different options. Primarily because we also do have a responsibility to be careful about other decision criteria, which include cost to ratepayers. And so what I'm proposing is that we should think through what it is our position will be about how to weigh these differences in safety relative to other criteria which are also important to public welfare. And the amount of money that people need to pay for electricity is directly related to welfare, particularly because for low-income homes, electricity bills can be a very large fraction of your total monthly costs. And with so many people unemployed these days, it's even more important for us to take those things as seriously as well, because they certainly have impact on public welfare. So I just was hoping we could spend a little bit of time to discuss this set of questions before we start into the rest of the meeting.
Well, I want to chime in with a related but different perspective, which is we could start by trying to come to a view amongst us, just three of us, about the relative risk of that activity we heard about last night, the spent fuel storage itself, and the transfer, and then the dry cast storage, compared to the risk while the plant is running every day, like it's running now. That's something that's not only right in the middle of our remit, but it's something on which we are incontrovertibly appointed to deal with, and we're experts in. You know, I mean, I only have two expertises in my life, and the one is I know how to get around my own house blind, and I know something about reactor safety, and those things we could opine about without controversy. If you start to then wander off, and I use that word pejoratively, wander off to comparing those risks with finances and economics, we can do that if you want. But I think that's not directly.
Bob, we do that all the time.
Of course we do, but I'm going to argue that.
No, as a committee, we do.
I'm not arguing with you, but it's not.
Of
course we do, but it's not as directly within our expertise as the obvious point of comparing the risks of dry cask storage and transfer and stuff to the risks of operation. That we can do. There's no question that we not only can do that, but I believe we have an obligation to do that. Now that we have the risk study under our belt, and if you believe me, it's a good one, then we have a basis for that comparison that's directly within our expertise, and I think the committee ought to start with that. Then if you want to then go beyond that, I'm not arguing you don't want to go beyond it, but I think you want to start with that.
Now, would Dr. Peterson and Dr. Butner, would it be appropriate to consider what Dr. Peterson is thinking about to have a discussion in our next public meeting? Or do you prefer we find time today to initiate this discussion?
The latter. I think we ought to talk about it now.
Yeah. I agree on that because I think that this is actually something that we can also begin to look at with some type of fact-finding work, but also so that the three members can spend some time but thinking through the set of questions so that we're prepared to have some discussion on the set of questions. And ultimately reach whether or not there's some sort of recommendation or conclusions that we will generate relative to this report and what it implies. But I would note that every single time that we say that the plant has done thing with appropriate or adequate level of safety, which we've concluded on many different things that the plant does,
all over the place.
That is a judgment about levels of difference in safety, which are frankly larger than the levels of difference in safety between these different options. These are really, really small numbers.
But that, Per, I not only agree with you, but that's exactly the point that I was saying we could opine about with expertise. That is for sure. We could say, maybe, I hope we will, that the levels of safety differences between operating the plant this way and this way and this way, just talking about today, have much bigger differences in safety implication than the differences we heard about last night.
Got it.
So what is the consensus on the table?
When do we
discuss this?
I think that this is, we have new information because we have these presentations. And so that it would be appropriate for us to place on our agenda for our next public meeting a topic for discussion of potential recommendations or conclusions related to this study and to the approaches that might be used to manage the offloading of the spent fuel from pools at Diablo Canyon.
But well, I don't think that it's out of order. Maybe Bob Rathy can tell us about the act that governs our proceedings. I don't think it's out of order for us to talk about it today during this meeting, in the context that we just had that three. It was 3 hours plus last night, and we can reflect on it here. It's the same meeting and talk about that. It's well within the scope of the current agenda. And then
that's actually, I think, what we're doing right now.
No, I'm not arguing the case. And then that could lay the groundwork for an agenda with perhaps several different subtopics to talk about at the next one.
I would agree with that.
The background.
Yeah. And the other thing is that I think planning for us and having it explicitly as an agenda item for the next public meeting, because there's not a rush to do this. There's not going to be any final decisions made about the approach in this intervening period. But having it also noticed, because, of course, right now I'm just checking the participant list, and we've got a few participants from the public, but we had more last night because this is such an interesting topic. It's good for us to defer that discussion until our
preference is to defer that, Dr. Butness. I think I, for one, need time to digest your excellent presentation last evening. I need time to go over what you inform us.
All right, so I got two comments to make. First of all, sure, we only have four attendees at the moment. Last night we had, I'm looking on my screen right here, we had about a dozen. But AGB told us there were 58 people who didn't appear on this list, but nevertheless were there. I don't know how many are out there now. Maybe they can tell us, but it's more than four. So I'm not worried about that. We had more. That's just a narrow point, but I think it's an important one. Secondly, I think we owe it to ourselves to have enough discussion here because, by the way, the three of us can only talk here. The next time we can talk is in the fall. That's the rules, and that's what we follow. I think the three of us ought to talk here enough to provide a firm basis for the agenda at the next meeting, including the possibility that we might want to have one or two presentations by outside people, or that we want to schedule some specific agenda time for our own discussion, or we want to hear from our consultants, or we want to task our consultants with doing this, that, or the other thing to bring to that meeting some background that would help us. In other words, I think now is the time for the three of us to plan that.
I have a related logistical point to throw in this mix. I happened to run across this morning the fact that the Diablo Canyon decommissioning engagement panel is meeting on this topic on September 9th, which happens to be the first day of Dr. Budnitz's and Mr. Wardell's fact-finding meeting. The committee might want to consider, at least in part, if not in whole, listening in on that meeting to get more input on some of the public opinion and issues that arise in that meeting. And that might enlighten the discussion in October as well.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
For you, they meet in the evening, typically. I haven't looked, but is that right? So we could just spend that evening. It's right in the middle of our 2 days.
Yep. I think that's a good idea.
That's called serendipity.
Let me chime in a second on the conversation y'all just had. It seems to me that we ought to wait for PG&E to decide what they're going to do about the risk study. Are they going to take one of the options and go with it? And we should wait for that, perhaps, and review that decision and comment on it rather than looking at the whole thing and running around with it. It's typically what we do. You know, we don't review a lot and tell them what to do or make recommendations a whole lot. We typically are reviewing their actions on things, their decisions on things, and saying whether we think it's proper or not.
I understand that perspective. In this case, our being on the record that the risks are small, which we're not on the record. I told you that yesterday when I was giving my presentation. I said that's Bob Budnitz's opinion. It's not the committee's opinion. Could have some weight in those deliberations. Or the point that the risks are, however you characterize them, are such that they shouldn't drive the decision by themselves. That by itself is a perspective that the committee hasn't spoken with one voice on. Now you're right. We can wait until October for that.
Actually, I think particularly with what Rick has said and the additional information that could be available to us at that time, does make a lot of sense for us to place this on the agenda as an agenda item. And we are able to develop our agenda. I believe we can get that put together in terms of concurring on what we want to cover in that special part of the meeting and that discussion. We can do that after this meeting.
Yes, indeed. So I believe now we had consensus that we would ask the committee's counsel to coordinate with our two technical consultants to develop an agenda item for our next public meeting.
I would agree with that. I don't want to take too much time. And of course, we do have also, we need to have public comment at the start of this day's of our meeting. And so I think that we have a path forward, which is to delegate to our consultants the responsibility to help us develop an agenda item related to discussion on the study and on options for the management of Smithfield.
Great. So the record is clear for that. Okay, yeah, great.
I would just like to note that I know we've talked about, developing it in a sense, a recommendation, the recommendation would then, if it was a formal recommendation in an annual report, it would not be until the annual report period for the 31st annual report, because our most recent annual report period closed on June 30th.
It closed yesterday or the day before, yeah.
Right. So but that doesn't preclude us from doing that. I just wanted to point that out.
We can get the message to them,
Yeah. Right. We can send information to our appointing agencies anytime we want.
Yes, we can. Yeah.
Okay, great. Any additional committee members' comments? There being none, let's go to the next item on our agenda, which is for public comments on matters not on the committee's agenda today. So any members of the public who wishes to address matters of their own concern, please raise your hand electronically.
Okay. And it could include matters that we talked about yesterday.
Yes, indeed. Any matter that they wish to address the committee on.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, we do have Mr. Wiseman, and so I'm going to allow him now. He should unmute himself, and he should be able to be heard.
Thank you, Mr. Vahi.
Good morning. David Weissman, Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility.
Welcome.
Thanks. Regarding this discussion this morning of a matter that isn't on today's agenda, I would say your next meeting was scheduled for when in October?
22nd and 23rd of October.
Right, that's what I thought, late October. Well, I don't know how many of you have the PowerPoint presentations from the Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Engagement Panel meeting that was just held a week or so ago. I'm sure Mr. Baldwin can get you a copy of Tom Jones's slides.
I have it.
You have it?
Yeah, but no, I have it, but maybe the others don't.
Okay, slide on page 98 of the presentation gives you the timeline. Well, according to that, the vendor evaluating of the vendor proposals is supposed to be completed by the end of September of this year. So it would seem to me that you would have those options available, exactly what I think Dr. Peterson was mentioning, or someone just mentioned, maybe it was Dr. Lamb, to have what PG&E actually is going to have before them as the possibility of choices. Now, I don't know if those vendor things will be under a non-disclosure agreement at that time, but certainly the three of you are privy to things involving non-disclosure agreements and PG&E's plans. So, yeah, I think either Dr. Peterson or Dr. Lamb was correct in that you might as well wait until you can see, because this is what they're actually going to be putting out for bid. This will be a reality. This will not be an abstraction at that time. So I would suggest that indeed putting the discussion off to the time, but making sure you have access, if it's permitted, to that information in advance, which will certainly give you a head start on analyzing the situation. And yes, you're quite right. I think Dr. Peterson mentioned it. There's indeed an absolute nexus between safety and economics. Safety costs money. The amount of safety or the amount of money you spend may be very well related to that. And since all the money spent is ratepayer money, and since you are chartered by the Public Utilities Commission, whose mandate is to provide that all rates are just, prudent, and reasonable, the nexus is quite direct on that. So,
Although it's fair to say that some of the money here comes from the judgment fund of the federal government, and it's not California ratepayer money.
Some of it, but the decommissioning costs.
That we understand each other. Yeah. We understand each other.
Yeah,
it's a mix.
And this is also a very important point. Let's capture this as an action, which is that we do want to have a fact finding that will review if we can obtain access the information about these different options, so that with appropriate protection of proprietary information, so that we can factor that information into the discussion that we'll have in our October meeting.
And also, Mr. Weissman, I certainly echo some of your sentiments. This committee has time. The process of selecting, designing, and manufacturing and licensing a CAS is not as expeditious as what has been broadcasted. You know, I, for one, am aware of numerous technical and policy barriers against extremely optimistic scenarios being broadcast by different participants. For example, the licensing schedule was forecast to be about 2 years. Well, let's hope that is a correct forecast, but I have serious concern about that very optimistic schedule.
Let me make this comment. It may be more of a question than a comment. The risk study and the spent fuel cask decision are not necessarily directly related. And by that, I mean the spent fuel risk study is one of timing. When does fuel leave the pool and go to the ISFSI? That could be done with existing casks without their having to make a decision on a new cask. Or it could be done, put off until new casks are decided on.
That's exactly right. Yeah. That is exactly right. That is exactly right. As a matter of fact, the impetus, according to senior management from Diablo Canyon, the principal impetus for performing the risk study is so that they are more informed about their selection about the refueling and decommissioning processes.
Well, but there's more to it, especially if they start a campaign while the plant is still running, as it is today. Our committee needs to be concerned about whether there's any interface, positive, negative, or neutral, with operating plant safety and this campaign, depending on how it's planned. We have an obligation to delve into that and understand whether or not there is any interface with the safety of operations, depending on those schedules. And if so, we can opine on it. And if there isn't, we can opine on that. I think that's something we need to do.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. But the reality is they currently had no inventory of existing cast to do any campaign. Right.
Right.
Well, when they do start campaigns again, we'll continue doing what we've done in the past as far as reviewing, Bob, what you just said.
Yeah, I think there's no question we'll do that. That's part of our remit. We'll continue to do that.
Exactly.
Right.
Okay, Mr. Rahi, do we have a second public comment?
I'm not quite finished yet.
Oh, I am sorry, Mr. Weissman.
Okay, y'all got off on the discussion answering there.
Well, we're having fun, you can tell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't had coffee yet, so this would be right. Again, remember, yes, that the reason there is no current campaign, remember, there had been a current campaign, and as we have pointed out in our testimony on numerous occasions, in spite of the, as Mr. Giesman mentioned yesterday, going back to 2008, the original idea was to lower the density of the pools. There had been a campaign, and the campaign was aborted by PG&E unilaterally, without consultation with the California Energy Commission. And that if one looks at why this becomes an issue, I think it not necessarily the Diablo Canyon decommissioning engagement panel's raising of the issue, as Mr. Soonan mentioned yesterday, but I think it was the Alliance filing an order to show cause against PG&E's attorneys for why they had abrogated that agreement and responsibility with the California Energy Commission. Anyway, that said, as to the origin of the situation, you're quite right when you say that when it looks like there is no campaign, remember that there was a campaign, there had been a campaign, which was PG&E that abandoned that campaign, which places us in this situation now, just to put some historical chronology into that.
Record. Yeah, and whatever that meant, the facts on the ground are now there's no cast sitting there that they can use. I mean, you know, that's just a fact on the ground.
Right, and as I'll echo Mr. Giesemann's opening remark yesterday, that we'll leave the rest of the dealing with PG&E till the 2021 NDCP, to NDCTP. But historically, that's the chronology. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Weissman. Mr. Rahi, do we have a second?
I see your hand raised. Does anybody have any additional comments this morning under public comments? Seeing none, Mr. Chairman, I think we can move on. We do have a change, as I reported yesterday, in our agenda. The first informational item to be presented this morning will be an item from the afternoon agenda, which is recent human performance issues in operations department causes and corrective actions. The item that was scheduled is item 5 on your agenda, cause and corrective actions for the February 2020 Unit 2 forced outage, has been deferred. I expect to a subsequent meeting based upon the receipt of some very recent information from Diablo Canyon. So with that, I think we're ready to proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Rahi, for the clarification. May I now then turn the podium to Mr. Tom Borman, who is the Director of Business Generation Planning.
Dr. Lamb.
Mr. Borman.
Thank you, Dr. Lamb. First up, we've got Dennis Peterson, who is our Director of Operations Services at Diablo Canyon. He's been in the spot for a year now, and he's been with PG&E for 33 years. He started his career within the operations department, was licensed by the NRC as a senior reactor operator, managed a crew, before moving to senior leadership, where he's held positions as director of quality verification, as an outage manager, director of learning services, and director of nuclear work management. So with that, I'll turn it over. He was also degreed as a BS in aeronautical engineering from Cal Poly, so a local boy for us. Mm-hmm. So if I can, I'll pass it to Dennis to tell us about what we've done with respect to the operations department performance. Dennis?
Okay, good morning, everyone.
Welcome.
You can hear me well.
Welcome.
Thank you. So, I prepared a slide deck. I assume the online version shows the slides. I'm not online. I'm just on the telephone today. And what I would refer to as current perspective. So in terms of current operations performance, I'll cover that. And then I'll cover some historical perspective after a few slides. So a current perspective, ops performance is very good. We've been on a journey to, you know, move, you know, towards excellence and improve our performance. What I would point to, you know, supporting that success have to do with effectively leveraging our performance monitoring and improvement tools. And among those that are most notable are crew management review meetings. We conduct those every week. The operating crew on day shift, the leaders, spend some time with the senior leadership and our plant manager, and we review a database of feedback and insights provided by the crews over the previous 5-week cycle, and identify learnings from those and insights, and then we take action on those. So that's been very helpful and important in our journey. I would point to recent plant power level changes that have been scheduled and executed very well. We, as you know, had a tunnel cleaning that involved maneuvering the unit to 50% and in one in sequence, removing from service our circulating water pumps for tunnel cleaning, restoring the plant to full power, and also a plant maneuvering for turbine valve testing and restoration of the plant power levels following that. So those were all done safe and error-free. We've had very good performance this year. We've had very good partnership with training. The manager of operations training is I'd say, so well embedded on my team that you'd hardly notice the difference that he doesn't work for me. He's always made himself available, and at times is a step ahead of us with setting the table for a training opportunity to help us out. I would point also to our COVID mitigation strategies and our senior leadership team reviewing those on a daily basis, and any updates on any COVID sickness calls. Our margins to our minimum staffing needs has been monitored on a continuing basis. And so we've had very little personnel unavailability. We've monitored our margin to, we've got a four-tiered threshold of staffing levels, and we've only touched the fourth tier level to take action a couple of times and do this sick calls, not COVID-related sickness, but non-COVID. As far as leadership changes, I felt it important to make sure you knew that we had some changes in our my leadership team. My previous ops manager has been requested to step over as a assistant to the plant manager or station director, we call him. And so Brian is fulfilling that role effective the first of this month. And the performance shift manager, who's been on our team for quite some time, is stepping up to fill in as the operations manager on an interim basis while I post and post the position interview and fill it permanently.
And who is that?
So, Dennis? That's Sam Williams.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Thank you. You may have met him.
Yeah.
In your recent past out here. So the net effect is we've had strong performance. We've recovered some shortfalls that we had to work on last year, and I'll speak to those in a moment. Flipping the page to the next slide, I would just want to let you know that we've implemented earlier this year an excellence plan. We identified the key drivers to performance shortfalls and identified actions to address those and close those gaps. And that's been instrumental in helping us continue in our journey to excellence. We transitioned that plan, from a previous action plan on status control. And we've strengthened our leadership engagement to drive improved performance. In doing that, one of the key tools we used was called a learning teams exercise. We benchmarked that from Chevron, and our corporate partners had a model of that in place up in the general office. So that was very helpful for us to engage our leaders. We also conducted a session with our nuclear operators and identified opportunities to strengthen our team, remove barriers, and improve our performance. So the only remaining action in the existing excellence plan is to complete an effectiveness review. I expect to wrap up that effectiveness review in the form of a series of assessments by the end of August. The due date for that is in September, before we commence our refueling outage this fall. And as I expect you would also agree with me, excellence is a journey. It's not a landing spot. So we are meeting this coming week on identifying what are the next low-level trends we're seeing, and we'll reshape our excellence plan based on low-level trends we're seeing and identify a new set of actions we're going to align the team on and focus on for the remainder of the year. So let's turn the slide to next one. You'll see a photo. That's my interim operations manager, Sam Williams, in the picture there. I use this slide to update you on our workforce planning and some items you may or may not be aware of. So as far as our nuclear reactor operator license classes, we completed a 2018 class in March with 100% pass rate. We're very pleased with that result. And those folks are assigned to crews, and they're engaged on a cruise now. Our class that launched last year in 2019 was is our largest ever at 24 candidates. Well, I'll say largest ever in my tenure. We may have had larger classes in our early years. I honestly, I'm not certain, but 24 people in the class is very large. Half of those are assigned to shift up to last week with the balance of the students in the classroom and the simulator. This week they are back all together again and doing some common training related to emergency plan and some of their other basic qualifications. So they just recently came back together this week for some this part of their schedule. The NRC exam for this class is next February. You may have already been aware of that, but I figured I'd point that out just for your benefit. And as far as our nuclear operators, so these would be non-licensed operating staff. We had a class that started March 16th. There are 11 folks in that class. They're progressing well. We had a few delays incurred due to our COVID strategies. We first had to roll back a number of training programs and go to remote learning. And so that did cause some delays, but the overall completion date is unchanged. It's November, late this year. As far as our attrition, which I figured you might want to know about, we've had lower attrition than we had originally forecast several years ago. So that's stood us well to have plenty of margin to staffing. And so we continue to monitor that through this fall and into next year. I expect a few people will retire this fall and then a few into the first quarter of next year. But we're in a good position to accommodate that.
Dennis, I've got a simple question. You have this new class that just started in March with 11 nuclear operators?
Yes, sir.
How many of those were employees of the power plant before? Most of them?
Oh, you know what? I don't remember how many. I don't think it's a whole lot of a very large number. Were there a few nuclear Navy folks in the class?
So these are, they're it's not mostly people already at the station. They're people from the outside
who
are joining the station through this class. I'm just curious.
That's correct.
Okay. I mean, obviously.
Yeah, I'd say.
You can pin down the numbers offline, but thank you.
Yeah, I'd be happy to share that with you if I can take a little homework. But just working from my recollection when I met them, one of them was from the oil sector over in the Bakersfield area. A lot of experience with rotating equipment and processes. There was an individual from another part of our company, a different line of business. There are a couple of military folks, very, very sharp folks, and then another blend of, I think there was a recent Cal Poly graduate joined us, and there were a few others. So I can prepare a summary if you'd like,
but that's
just
okay.
From my recollection.
Thank you.
Mr. Peterson.
You don't have to do a lot of work on that. I just thought perhaps the public would be worth informing them that, just what the mix is. You said they're mostly not just coming from inside, but they're new hires coming into this class to become nuclear operators.
That's correct. There are a few from the community and then a few just beyond our county.
Thank you.
Mr. Peterson, this is Peter Lamb. Good morning. This is indeed good news. Knowing that the facility is going to be shutting down in the not too distant future, you still have a great deal of capability of recruiting and retaining talent in the crucial area of reactor operators. So this is indeed good news.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm not taking credit for any of that. Our station as a whole, and then my predecessors have, thoughtfully considered what our attrition might be, worst case, and worked with our senior leadership to gain alignment and agreement to fund the sufficient staffing pipeline that we need, because it does take a significant amount of time to train and qualify licensed operators as well as non-licensed operators. And so, yeah, we've had that that plan set and established some years ago, and so it's serving a good purpose here. And that allowed us, to my last bullet, to hire in advance of our forecast attrition so that we can maintain our margins.
Yeah, by the way, the thrust of my question was just exactly what you touched on. I want you to imagine something that's different than what's on this slide, that you are having difficulty filling this, that you really weren't able to fill it with people that were qualified, and you're gonna come up short, because after all, the thing is going to run for another 4 or 5 years. And your report is just the opposite, and that was the thrust of what I was asking. Thank you.
Yeah, that's exactly why. Thank you, Dr. Budnitz. Okay, so if we can turn the next slide. The next slide is simply a section divider, and so I'll turn to the slide listing operator fundamentals. And so I believe this is what prompted your request for a briefing to begin with. And I don't recall when your agenda item was identified and what triggered it, but I presume it was related to a plant status control error that we incurred last November, and that was the subject of an NRC fourth quarter report, where we had intended to wait for a mode change back into mode 5, where equipment was no longer required, and then we were going to tag the equipment out. We did that prematurely, just due to a human error. It was not intended to be dispatched, but ended up being dispatched in error to a team of operators. This was during our refueling outage last fall. And so when we stepped back and looked at that and any similar events over the past year, we identified what we needed to focus on was what we call operator fundamentals. And I listed the definition here on the slide. These are well known in the nuclear industry through the Institute of Nuclear Power, and they represent the essential knowledge, skills, and practices that individuals and crews must exhibit to operate the plant well. Using these fundamentals, you know, you have to have a focus on proficiency and engagement. So while those are not themselves fundamentals, they're essential to implement well. The fundamentals are on the next slide. I'll if you would, flip the slide to the operator fundamentals dashboard. This is a communication tool I'm having published to help us raise our level of communication on these topics and, you know, our level of inquiry and advocacy on them. So the operator fundamentals, there are monitoring closely, controlling precisely, having a conservative bias, operating effectively as a team, and plant knowledge. And so I won't read all the words that are there for you, but because you can read them and see that proficiency and operator engagement are essential to implement those well, and that's what this slide is really trying to say. My previous my ops manager that's been in the saddle with me for my journey here back in operations launched a campaign last year. The discs you see at the bottom of this slide for each of the operator fundamentals. He had these coins made up. They're kind of like little chips with the graphic depiction on here. And he launched a campaign to award an operator fundamental coin for above and beyond performance on our operating crews. And that's been, I'll point to that as adding a level of healthy competition and advocacy amongst our operating crews to demonstrate those operator fundamentals well. And it's been a very effective tool. He's handed out, I don't know, a couple dozen of these. We like to present them and celebrate them in a group forum with the crew. And so those have been very effectively leveraged, and we will continue to use those as our tools to raise our level of dialogue and kind of inculcate this into our language more frequently. So that's been an effective a tool to help us all perform. And if you looked at our trends today, you'll find our trends are solidly in an excellent category. And we will continue to focus on low-level errors so that we sustain this excellent performance. So that's what I prepared to say, and I'm ready to address questions by the committee.
Committee members' comments to Mr. Peterson's presentation? Dr. Butness, Dr. Peterson?
I'd like to say it was excellent. I really appreciate it. Thank you, Dennis.
Dr.
Yes, Butner. Of course, Dr. Peterson.
I have a question. Dennis Furman Wardell here. A good presentation.
Good Could morning.
You elaborate a little bit on the effectiveness review you alluded to?
Yeah, certainly. So the effectiveness review is something that I laid in the plan to make sure that, you know, that my team didn't just wrap up a number of actions and then move on, that we reflected on, okay, you know, at some point in time, it's pretty typical for a significant cause eval that we would do this. And I thought it was important for my team to treat this in the same manner. So, you know, in broad sense, I would I asked my team, hey, three to six months after the last major corrective action, let's look at how our performance is doing, and that allows us to reflect on have we fully addressed all of the drivers to the gaps we identified? Did anything get by us? Is there any recurrence of trouble? And if so, we will do a check and adjust. We will take additional actions if needed. So we'll be doing a couple of quick hit, we call them quick hit assessments, aimed at a couple of the key areas that we took action on. And so those will be completed, I expect, in August.
Okay, so Dr. Peterson and I will be out later in July. It might be a little too early to get the results of the effectiveness review, but it sounds like Dr. Budnitz and I will be, or our August or September fact-finding meeting. Might be a good time to go over that with you.
Certainly. Yeah, I don't know that we'll be complete when you're here, but I could certainly elaborate on more of the details on what the assessments will look at if they're not done, and the results if they are. Yeah, I'd be happy to do that.
I'm thinking September might be a good one. All right, mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Additional comments from the committee? There being none, let's entertain public comments on Mr. Peterson's presentation. Mr. Rahi, do we have any electronic hand being raised for members of the public?
At this point, Mr. Chairman, I see no hands raised.
Let me again invite members of the public to provide comments on Mr. Peterson's excellent presentation. There being none, we are ready to move on to next. Oh, let me thank Mr. Peterson again for a very informative presentation. Thank you.
I'm glad it served its purpose. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's move on to the next item on our agenda, and let me pass the podium again to Mr. Tom Baldwin. Mr. Baldwin.
Thank you, Dr. Lamb. Next, we're going to be hearing from Matt Coward regarding our upcoming Unit 1 refueling outage number 22. Matt is a degreed mechanical engineer from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. He is a registered professional mechanical engineer. He started in our engineering department, moving to progressing levels of responsibility, and ultimately went into our operations department, where he was licensed by the NRC as a senior reactor operator and led our operations crews. He subsequently moved into positions of our operations planning manager and then to outage manager. So with that, I'll turn it over to Matt to tell us about what we're doing with our refueling outage this fall. Matt?
Great, thank you, Tom. First, a little technology check, and everybody.
Welcome, welcome.
Outstanding. And Hector, you're driving the slides? Very good. I know everybody wants to hear about the pandemic and the outage, so just wait for it. It's coming. So 1R22 is scheduled to start October 4th, and it is currently, we're planning on a 30-day schedule. Our major scope for the outage is steam generator eddy current testing. This is currently required by our license. This is an every third refueling outage activity, so this would be the last eddy current testing that we plan on doing on the units. Additionally, we're doing reactor hot leg nozzle ultrasonic inspections. This is done by one of our vendors, Westinghouse, and it is done underwater using a robotic machine that ultrasonically tests, looking for flaws in the hot leg nozzles. We're replacing reactor coolant pump seals. We're replacing the refueling manipulator crane variable frequency drive. This is part of our ongoing efforts for fuel handling equipment reliability. Polar crane overspeed trip modification. I believe many of you on the committee were familiar with the issue we had during the last Unit 1 outage. We fixed the problem on Unit 2, and we plan on fixing the problem on Unit 1 in 1R22. Refueling cavity upender bushing replacement. These are the bushings that are down in the lower cavity. So when we're offloading or reloading the core, fuel is placed in the upender, and then the upender is lowered to a horizontal position to travel through the fuel transfer tube. And we discovered last year in one outage that we had wear on the bushings. This is a radiologically significant job, kind of like eddy current, because we're going into an extremely contaminated area. Good plans and vendor support set up for that. Low pressure turbine Charlie removal and inspection. This is part of our ongoing inspections. This should be the last for LP Charlie to the end of life. Circulating water pump, motor overhaul.
Matt, on that low pressure turbine, there's nothing particularly troubling about that. That's I understood it to just be a routine. You got to do it on the schedule that you're doing. Is that correct?
Dr. Budnitz, that is correct. We've already looked at three of the six.
Yeah, I understood. I just wanted to make sure that there wasn't something that I had overlooked.
No. We've looked at three of the six, and they've been pristine. So we have high confidence that when we look at this fourth of the six LP turbines between both units.
Right, and that'll be the last one for this.
That's correct. Intake cooling water heat exchanger 112 bundle replacement. This is to address problems we have with tube leakage. What intake cooling water does is it uses salt water to cool a closed cooling water system that then cools the circulating water pumps, one of which we're overhauling. This is a 4 kV and 480 volt vital bus hotel outage. No modifications. We've replaced all of the 480 volt vital breakers that we have planned on. So this is a pretty straightforward routine maintenance window. Two new jobs that one new and one that we did last outage. The 230 tower replacement. So if you visualize the plant, the 230 tower, the last one before entering the power block, is a common tower for both units. So the lines come down from the 230 switchyard, and then they both connect on this one tower. This tower is outside the protected area, and then the power lines then come in and split. There's two sets of power lines. One set goes to Unit 1, one set goes to Unit 2. So this is not a Diablo Canyon project. This is a transmission reliability and public safety replacement. Right now the plan is to replace it like for like, and we'll talk about this a little more later. And then for 500 kV tower replacements, I don't know if you noticed on one of the divider slides that Mr. Peterson had, showed a helicopter with somebody dangling off the end. That is actually a video from 2R21 when our line department used helicopters to replace all the insulators on the first off 500 kV line. So if you're standing at the power plant and you're looking at the 500 kV lines, they go up to a tower again that's outside the protected area. And so we are replacing all their insulators on the first off tower on Unit 1. And again, this is not a Diablo Canyon project. This is in support of our grid reliability. Questions on this slide?
Matt, yes, Vernon here. The third item, reactor coolant pump seal replacements. These are the replacing the new Westinghouse seals?
Yes. So four outages ago, We replaced all of the Westinghouse RCP seals with the new design, the so-called shutdown seals, that are designed that if they get too warm, that they will actuate and they will actually seal off. We got the coolant pump seals. It removes one of our vulnerabilities on a loss of all AC. And so these are very effective in both our probabilistic risk assessment numbers, as well as our Fukushima loss of AC power response. They are good for four cycles. So the plan is we are actually replacing these just based on time-based preventative maintenance. This should be the last set of reactor coolant pump seals that we replace on this unit.
Okay, good. That's what I thought. Thank you.
Hey, Matt, Rick McWhorter here, steam generator inspections. We got a briefing on that in March, and we were told at that time the secondary side inspections for Unit 1, that an evaluation was being prepared to defer those. Has that been completed, and is that a final decision to defer the secondary side inspections?
I would more characterize it as part of our scoping negotiation for 1R22. I know that maintenance and outage management engineering sat down and came up, and we aligned on a set scope of work that fits within our budget constraints for the secondary side. So I believe it's 10% circ water pump or main condenser tubes inspections, particularly along the periphery, which is our vulnerability. And we're doing some feed water heater eddy current inspections. The only scope that is still in question is the in-core neutron detector system thimble tubes. These are the thimble tubes that go up through the bottom of the reactor, and they are used for us to do a flux map at power because it allows us to put the probe actually into the reactor. And so we're still evaluating the technical merits of not doing that eddy current testing. And the reason is really kind of contingency planning. It is a very RP intensive. And as part of our COVID contingency planning, we're looking at what happens if we don't get the number of RP techs that we anticipated. So this is one where we're asking engineering to do the homework to say, hey, if we run into the situation where we can't get sufficient radiation protection technicians to cover this job, do we have a technical basis for deferring it to the next outage? Does that kind of answer your question? It's kind of a long question.
Yeah, but
long answer to a short question.
It was helpful information, but my question was specific to the secondary side steam generator inspections and cleaning.
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed. We were talking eddy current. This is the sludge lancing and foreign object search and retrieval. And yes, that has been decided. We will not do that. And that went through many, many rounds of discussion and with engineering and leadership. So right now, unless we see something on the eddy current probes, which is on the primary side, unless there's something detected by the probes that is perhaps sitting on the tube sheet, the plan is to right now is to not go into the secondary side of the steam generators. And part of the basis was the sludge removal. Unlike our old steam generators where we get hundreds of pounds of sludge, we, in our last sludge lancing, we were getting 5, 6, 7 pounds of sludge per steam generator. So it was a large resource investment for not a huge return.
Great, thank you.
Matt, I've got a question about the critical path. I had remembered that the hotel bus work is on the critical path. So what are you doing to two things? First, to speed that up, and also to make sure it doesn't go slow.
Okay, Hector, I don't have. Unfortunately, I didn't bring home my hard copy slide. I believe I got a critical path slide coming up. Hector, is that correct?
Oh, it could be. I had remembered reading that, and maybe it's on the next slide. Yeah, there it is. But
okay, wait for it.
Okay, but that's okay. We can talk about it here. So
okay. Go ahead and switch the slide, Hector.
Okay. Well, there it is. Okay, I hadn't. Okay, but so just to ask the question right while I'm here. There are two issues. One, you'd sure like to speed that up by pre-staging everything you can. And then you also have to have contingency to make sure it doesn't go slow and then hold everything up. So you can talk about that?
Yeah, so it in recent outages, it has not been unusual for a vital bus to be on a critical path. So per our added safety plan, we are allowed to clear a vital bus after we remove the upper internals. And the reason for that is once you remove the upper internals, we credit the 450,000 gallon refueling cavity for passive cooling on a loss of decay heat removal. We have to have it back to perform our emergency core cooling system valve interlock test. You're probably familiar with it. It's known as PEP V7 Bravo. And just like every critical path activity, we have a focused bus hotel critical path. We are working with electrical maintenance to make sure that as we hire, that we absolutely have the right mix of quals. Traditionally, what has been a challenge is relay qualifications. So I know myself and Mike Quitter are working with Alan Wilson, the electrical maintenance manager, to make sure. Right now, I feel good about it because there's no new work that we've done. And I think we know where the discovery is. So I'll give you an example. One piece of discovery is the 4 kV to 480 volt transformer has an internal spacer that is there for seismic issues. And in the past, we found that spacer misaligned and we had to go in and reposition it. So knowing that, we're scheduling that discovery and that boroscope on that spacer early in the bus hotel outage. So does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, because this, for example, in these longer outages, that's just definitely not on the critical path at all. You weren't nervous about it.
Yeah, I'm always nervous about concerned about critical
path. Well, of course.
I think bus hotel, we've got a good set of tools to monitor and see bow wave issues coming, see if the shop is getting behind, and take action to remedy that before it hits critical path. It's a 9-day window, so we ought to be able.
I just took you off video, so they can't see you walking in.
If we're on track within the first day or two. Other questions? Okay, I apologize. All right, we were testing our voice automated notification system, and that's why my cell phone was ringing. So critical path goes through our cool down and depressurization. Included under that is also our vital bus transfer testing and our integrated safeguards testing. Then we do reactor disassembly until we remove the upper internals, as mentioned. Then we will clear and tag out Vital Bus Hotel. Vital Bus Hotel will go through. Right now, it is the critical path to getting to the ECCS valve interlock testing, and that requires all three vital buses. Once that complete, we have some primary system fills to do. Then we will reload the reactor, reassemble the reactor, and then it's a pretty standard outage of heat up and testing, start the reactor, do the low power physics testing, and roll the main turbine parallel to the grid. Other questions on critical path? Okay, Hector? Okay, so first time evolutions is the 230 kV tower replacement. Now, this is the first time we replaced the tower. Last outage, we did do some repairs on the tower. But this is a total tower replacement. The other thing that this is pertinent is this is not just a unit one site 230 outage. As I had mentioned, both units 230 power comes down to the same pole and then it splits and goes to unit one and unit two. So replacing the tower requires us to unit two to enter a 72-hour shutdown action based on an inoperable startup. So just back to your question on how am I monitoring critical path on Bus Hotel, how am I monitoring success of this project? And a big key for that is there is significant pre-outage work that has to occur, including some inspections and some analysis for where the rebar is located in the foundation, as well as prefabbing the replacement tower. So a key to this success is paying attention to, are we hitting our marks on the pre-outage preparation, both the foundation and then the fabrication and inspection of the new tower. Questions on that? Okay. So COVID contingency planning. Right now, unlike, just to give you a little background, when the pandemic first hit, outage managers kind of naturally bonded together. We have a weekly phone call with both the fleets and individual stations, as well as the Canadians and with the CANDU plants, and the even some folks from Sizewell EDF in Britain. So we have weekly phone calls. We watched the spring outages, both the good, there are some plants that had minor impacts, and then both the cautionary tales of, for instance, Fermi was significantly impacted by the pandemic, and ultimately they're still in their outage. So right now the plan is to complete the full scope of work. We're doing some contingency plan and technical evaluations in case we run into vendor support issues. And one example is the one I gave you previously, which was the eddy current testing of the thimble tubes. Our social distancing protocols are well developed. Right now, what we're working on is a communication plan with our vendors and our TAs. So this outage, I believe, will bring in somewhere in the neighborhood of 600 people, 500 to 600 people. The plan is to develop a testing protocol for our vendor partners. We don't have the details on what that looks like, but the two major vendors with the significant number of people to bring it in are Siemens for the low pressure turbine project, and then Westinghouse for fuel handling, assistance in reactor disassembly, and also the steam generator eddy current, and the reactor hot leg nozzles. So I'll give an example of what we're looking at on thinking outside the box for social distancing. So one of the things that we learned from our peers in Palo Verde is all of the analysts, the steam generator eddy current analysts who look at the data that's collected, is they set up a high-speed Verizon and never had the analysts come on site. So that's 8 to 10 people that if we don't need them on site, we won't have them on site, and we'll set up the technology to get the data so that we don't lose time on the eddy current analysis. Positive case protocol, we have one. Right now, it's in the process of being revised to address the unique circumstances around a refueling outage. We have a COVID team that we kicked off 3 weeks ago, and this is for senior leaders to make strategic decisions. Like testing thermal cameras for the security access building. That's one of the things we're evaluating. Some plants have implemented, whereas part of your processing through the security building, you process through an automated thermal scanner that will then alarm if you exceed a certain temperature. The real focus of this team is focus on protecting our workers and ensuring that we have reliable plant operations for the next fuel cycle. So that is the rationale on, we are optimistic and are planning on doing the full scope of work, but as a true outage manager, we have contingency plans and risk rankings and things that if we find ourselves resource constrained due to the pandemic and it's changing every day, that we have at least put some thought, some technical evaluation into scope that we might elect not to do.
Mr. Carwood, yes. May I interrupt? This is Peter Lam. Since you mentioned testing protocol, what is your current testing capability? Are you able and willing to test everyone who entered the facility, or are you just test people who are symptomatic?
Based on our corporate guidance, we don't have a testing protocol requirement. Right now, to report to Diablo Canyon, you're asked to self-screen, and that's how we've been handling it, and then self-report. Now, I believe, and Tom, you can help me on this, we did have our first positive COVID case for a Diablo Canyon employee. They didn't get it from work, but we recognize that a protocol that works with PG&E regular employees coming to work is not necessarily the successful one when you have a large group of contractors coming in. So the short answer, Dr. Lamb, is no, I don't have those details now, but we are working on what those details are and what the testing capacity would look like and what the turnaround time. And of course, that's very fluid based on the recent increase in coronavirus cases.
Matt, okay. Matt, you weren't with our meeting yesterday, but we had public comment. You know, we have public comment all the time, and we had a public comment along the way yesterday by some member of the public who was concerned about the COVID situation with all these people coming in from the outside, and who characterized. I'm trying to remember the characterization. I have to go and look it up to see what. But anyway, it was characterized as a bunch of cowboys out there that go from site to site, and they're going to come here too. And you can finish the sentence about contaminating us. And that characterization seemed to me to be a caricature, but I'm not arguing the case. Do you have any comment about that perception and what your plans you're describing here are planning to do to assure not only yourself but assure the public that's going to be okay?
Yeah. So Doctor, the way I characterize it is cowboys don't survive very long in the nuclear power industry.
Say that again.
We are a rule-based industry. And we are very, very good at making and following rules and reinforcing rules. And so what I've seen when I go on site is the in-house staff means well. They want to. They occasionally need a reminder. It's an unnatural behavior to wear a mask and to maintain social distance. So the people who are coming in, I think our focus and the reason we're heading down the testing is – we don't want somebody who is already sick coming to work. If they're coming to work and then they contract something while working, then that's why we're looking at doing the screening process prior to the security building. But again, I guess my response would be is these are nuclear professionals, and the fact that they go to plant to plant to plant means that they know they have to follow plant rules, even if they're different from the previous plant.
Matt, that wasn't my characterization. I was characterizing something that we heard yesterday.
Okay,
thank you. I wanted to just, it's an easy question to ask. Since the COVID crisis hit, it's been 4 months now, there's several other plants in the U.S. have gone through an outage. Not here, but elsewhere. You bet they did. And obviously that experience has to be relevant. And I know for sure that you're part of a national group of people like you who communicate with each other. Can you share with us what those communications with the other plants have taught us in terms of learning for Diablo?
Yeah.
Particularly Sizewell, Mr. Kawa, Sizewell.
Okay, Dr. Lamb, you might have stumped me. I don't have my Sizewell specific notes. But what we have learned is at a high level, listening to this is one, you have to have some sort of screening, be it self-screening, temperature screening at the security building. There needs to be some sort of screening. Two, there has to be clear expectations on PPE use and social distancing. So that was a cautionary lessons learned that I gleaned from Fermi. Fermi did not make a rule that you had to wear a mask.
By the way, for the public to know, Fermi is a nuclear power plant near Detroit.
Yes. So
they'll know. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Buttons. So early on, they strongly encourage, again, like I referred to our nuclear professionals, they're great at following rules. But if it's not a rule, then they're also really smart and exercise their own judgment. So
one of the keys is make it a site standard, just like using handrails going upstairs, make a site standard that you will mask up if you're within 6 feet, and that you will self-screen, and that you will maintain social distancing. And if you can't maintain social distancing, you'll elevate it. So I think we're in good shape there. And then there's some nuts and bolts practicality stuff for in-processing that we've looked at for both to maintain our throughput. In the past, we would have web-based training and we'd have computers and you'd be sitting, it was like a call center. You'd be sitting right next to somebody. But our team's gotten creative. We've taken over some more classrooms and a couple of trailers. So we now have a socially distant web-based training facilities. It's scattered over the site. That allows us to maintain the 6 foot distance. So I think the key takeaway for me is have clear standards and then just reinforce them.
Matt, one question is that one concern is that workers may come to work even if they're not feeling well, because taking sick leave consume sick leave, and there's a variety of factors that historically, you know, people sometimes will come to work when they're not feeling well. Under COVID, we really don't want that to happen, and we want people, if they're not feeling well, to stay home. And one of the reasons for doing the temperature screen is to have a way to diagnose. Anybody who's running a fever definitely should not be coming into work. But what are the things that you do to assure that workers will make the correct decision about staying at home, even if there might be an economic impact from not coming to work?
Well, I think a big piece of that is our communication. So we're spending a lot of effort on our written communication and our verbal communication, because we begin out of gin processing in the next couple of weeks. That's where we start reaching out to people who have worked here before. We say, hey, this is when the outage is. And so one of the things we're working on right now is what that communication looks like. And I think you're right. There's always going to be somebody who thinks, well, I got a fever, but it's not COVID, or they will convince themselves they're okay to go to work. And that's where that's why we need to set up and plan on setting up some form of screening. When the pandemic first hit, we set up and you were screened in your car. I think we've got some lessons learned that is just not practical, extremely cumbersome for a refueling outage. And that's why we're looking at some of the technology. Again, so in Kansas, Wolf Creek has deployed the temperature scanners that you walk through prior to going in the security building. So what we're looking at is their operating experience. Hey, are these things working for you? You know, I don't wish ill on anybody, but hopefully they pick up a positive as operating experience. Hey, these machines work. And then we would look at doing something similar.
Got it.
Matt, Rick McWhorter again. I know in our May fact finding, we talked about the recent tunnel cleanings and the fact the supplemental personnel were basically set up with a completely separate security screen for that work in order so that they wouldn't essentially mix with the more critical PG&E operations and maintenance employees. Are you going to take that kind of approach in the outage, and to what degree or not degree will the supplementals and the regular employees mix during security screening and such?
Yeah, so for tunnel cleanings and the laborers we bring in to do the tunnel cleanings, they are not badged employees. So we are able to process them and keep them separate. The one thing I can't do is build a second security facility. But what we are looking at doing is staggering shift times, anything to reduce the throughput through the security search train. That really is our choke point. Once you get past there, we have various options to go to your work site that we're exploring to maintain the social distance. But for the unbadged workers, we're doing the same thing we did during the tunnel cleaning, where they don't go through the search train, they get briefed outside separate, and then they go and go to work in the tunnels.
Thank you.
Okay, next slide. Okay, so just wanted to mention our major partners. I alluded to this earlier. Westinghouse, they're doing the hot leg nozzle inspections, the fuel handling, and the reactor coolant pump seal replacement. Not included on this, and that's my fault, is eddy current testing. So Westinghouse will also be doing the steam generator primary manways, the steam generator eddy current data collection, and the analysis.
About how many Westinghouse people?
Depending on how much they're sharing between the eddy current crew and the refuel crew, we should probably be somewhere in the neighborhood of about 30. Okay, but that depends because some of them are cross-trained. So, for instance, some of the fuel handling crew is also qualified to remove primary steam generator manways. So there's some overlap, and I haven't looked at the specifics on, but for this scope of work and the fact that the eddy current occurs in the core offload window, I'd say approximately 30 plus their supervision.
Those are the people on site. Now, of course, they're backed up by people in headquarters who have done analysis and various things, right?
That's correct. Those are the people who have to come on site, who we badge.
Right. Sure.
We're doing the physical work inside containment and inside the fuel handling building. And then Siemens, they're doing the low pressure Charlie inspection. That is their critical path. And that's the lion's share of the work. And in addition, as always, we're doing four of the main turbine valves. We're doing a stop valve, a governor valve, a reheat intercept valve. And those are the major valve inspections. Questions on our vendor partners? Okay, Hector? That's all I have. Any other questions, concerns around 1R22?
Comments from the committee, our members and our technical consultants, and the comments on Mr. Carwood's outstanding presentation. There being none, let's entertain public comments on our speaker's presentation. Mr. Rahi, do you see any hands raised electronically? Mr. Rahi?
Nope, there's nothing there.
I'm sorry, I was muted. There are no hands raised at this time, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, that being the case, let me thank Mr. Conwood for an outstanding and informative presentation on a matter of utmost importance to the committee and to members of the public. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Nice work.
And then we had one more item before we adjourn the morning sessions. Committee's member, do you like to go ahead or would you like to take a break? What is your preference?
I would love to have a break.
Okay.
Ten minutes?
Yes, please.
I'll second Bob. Let's take a break.
Sure, 10 minutes break.
If only to be fair to Rick.
Okay. 10:35 Pacific.
Yes, indeed. 10:35. Perfect. Mr. Travis, are we ready?
The web stream is live.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Hey.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back after our 10 minutes break. We are now ready to go to the next item on our agenda, which is for the committee's technical consultant, Mr. Rick MacArthur, to present his fact findings report. Mr. MacArthur, the floor is yours.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just cut in on Mr. MacArthur's floor for just a minute. I sent around an email that I forwarded from Bob Lloyd this morning that showed it shortly after 9. We had 116 people on the live stream.
You're talking about this morning?
That was this morning from Bob Lloyd, yes.
Oh, excellent. Thank you, Council.
I know we had 58 last night, and looks like more tomorrow. I'll have to find out if that is, in fact, the correct number, but I have no reason to think it isn't.
That's excellent news. Thank you.
Well,
okay, so I can go ahead. All right, this is a report on a fact-finding visit by Dr. Peterson and myself on May 12th and 13th, and this fact-finding was conducted in its entirety remotely via WebEx. First item on our agenda was to meet with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Many of the topics we've already talked about in this public meeting with the other presentations. We did also discuss the resident inspector assignment rotations coming up. It is a little unusual for both of them to be rotated in the same year. We talked about that a little bit with Chris, and he did point out that one of the newly assigned inspectors, I can't remember whether it's replacing the resident or the senior resident, but she had been assigned an interim to Diablo Canyon, so she had a little bit of a head start and experience to be gained, so there'll be some consistency to the turnover there among the resident inspectors. Next item on our agenda was to review the history of variable frequency drive modifications to the polar cranes. This was an item of interest in general to Dr. Peterson, following up on the issues that have been had with the containment polar crane and overspeed trips a couple of outages ago. I think it also reflects the fundamental desire of mechanical engineers to want to do electrical engineering work for them. Certainly is interesting a lot of times for us to do that. But in general, variable frequency drives are actually fairly rare in the nuclear industry because most pumps run at fixed speed, most equipment run at fixed speed around nuclear power plants, being older designs. In the situation with cranes have a need for slow speed movement, be precise movements for moving their loads. So many of them are equipped with variable frequency drives. When Diablo Canyon was built, these cranes, the polar cranes in particular, used older motor generator set technology where you have a DC motor driving an AC generator that produces a variable frequency to drive a motor at variable speed. In the early 2000s, there were a lot of problems that developed with the DC motor drive cards on the polar cranes at Diablo Canyon, resulted in some outage delays, some unreliability, and the cards were becoming hard to obtain replacements due to obsolescence. So a design change package was planned and implemented in 2012 and 2013. To replace the motor generator sets with solid-state variable frequency drives. They provided us with documentation describing the drives and the design changes that were performed during that time. There was a vendor that specialized in crane variable frequency drives that was selected. The work was actually piloted on another crane elsewhere in the plant before being used for the technology being used for the polar cranes. The approach was fairly unique in that the variable frequency drives for the polar crane were designed to be installed on the ground level of containment. All the equipment was designed to be put there to be easily accessible and also uses quick disconnects such that the variable frequency drives can actually be taken out of containment between outages. That allows for maintenance on the drives because they have some capacitors that need regular maintenance, as well as it allows one unit's variable frequency drive to be a standby set to be used on the other unit if needed during the next outage as a spare set. So it's a fairly well thought out design that implemented this feature in 2012 and 2013, and we judged that it was a very appropriate use of the technology and design. We also inquired where else the VFDs are used in the plant, and certainly refueling equipment we've already heard about. They are in the process of changing variable frequency drives on the manipulator cranes. I believe unit 2 is complete already, and unit 1, as Mr. Coward mentioned, is planned for this fall. The spent fuel pool crane also has variable frequency drive, as well as chemical addition skids and other cranes in the plants. Our conclusion was that this modification was a good modification. It's performed properly implemented earlier and controlled appropriately through the process. Next item on our agenda was to review training programs. We were on a rotation to review training programs in general, and it turned out appropriate to review them specifically in the context of what was going on during the pandemic. And we were provided a very well-organized brief that basically stepped us through each of the training programs at the plant, the major training programs, and how they were being affected by the pandemic. And I'll just kind of walk through each one of those in succession here. The first program is licensed operator continuing training, otherwise known as requalification training. This is for NRC licensed operator. This training is required by regulations, it moves to the top of the list as far as continuance of the training. Diablo Canyon has been able to continue that training without the need for any exemptions to the regulations. There was a two-week delay initially in March to adjust to the new routines and new requirements that the pandemic placed on training. That delay was absorbed with a planned two-week gap that was later in the schedule. But basically, all the licensed operator training was moved to be remote WebEx training for the classroom training, and the licensed operator continuing training for the simulator and examinations once the classroom times were done were brought back on site a few weeks later. Quite a bit of work went into scheduling the simulator sessions, both for licensed operator continuing training and other training, to minimize the risk to the crews. In the end, essentially, the crews were scheduled at times on the simulator such that they would be given a whole day, one crew, and minimize interaction with other crews on the simulator. The simulator would be sanitized between sessions, and the crews were required to wear masks and gloves and maintain social distancing during the simulator training sessions. But all that simulator training now has been picked up, and licensed operator continuing training is moving forward with the schedule without interruption at this time. The next major category of training is initial licensed operator training. I believe Mr. Peterson already touched on this, but repeat it briefly here. The initial licensed operator training are the reactor operator and senior reactor operator candidates for the NRC exam in February of 21, currently scheduled for February of 21. That class was immediately shifted to WebEx at the time the pandemic hit. Some of the simulator and in-plant training portions of their schedule were deferred, but those have both been restarted now. Simulator was restarted in April for that group, and in-plant was restarted in May. There was a lot of thought given to the on-the-job training, the implant portion of their training, to make sure they would stay as isolated as they could from and minimize the risk not only to the trainees but also to the operating ship that they were paired with. The next category was also touched by Mr. Peterson, is the non-licensed operator training class. This is basically the non-licensed operators that serve on shift. There was a new hire group that reported to the site literally the week the pandemic was beginning, and the station basically put them through the minimal in-processing necessary to bring them on board as employees, and then sent them home with computers and instructed them to do generic online training, what is called Nantail training. We've talked about that previously with regards to being used by the station to train supplemental employees. But they did quite a bit of generic training online while the class was restructured, and then it was decided to bring that group back to in-person training using the PG&E Education Center auditorium, which served as a large enough space that the trainees could maintain social distancing in a classroom environment. So that training is now picked up and back to in-person training at that location. The other training plans, engineering training, continue to move forward as scheduled pretty much with WebEx. Maintenance training, which is much more hands-on, was delayed But as the time of their visit in May, they were close to being able to restart that training and have appropriate controls in place to be moving on that again. And our conclusion was the training appeared to be successfully continuing during the COVID-19 pandemic. Next item on our agenda was emergency diesel generators, the routine item on our list. Certainly, if AFW is Dr. Burgess's, Mr. Wardell's favorite systems, this is one of mine. We got a very good brief on emergency diesel generators. These generators are six of them located at the station, and they're used to provide power during shutdown or an accident situation when the plant has experienced a loss of off-site power. Both units, the emergency diesel generators, were in green health, good health. This is a significant point. And I did a little research back as far as I could find reports to 2013, and this has never previously been the case, at least back to that point. We've even had a point in 2014 where systems on both units were rated as red for emergency diesel generators. So in general, the health is significantly improved on all six diesel generators overall, and there are very few specific issues ongoing with the diesel generators at this time. One is the planned replacement of the governors to an upgraded model. That's to address obsolescence concern. The Unit 1 governors are all being replaced. One was done at the time of our visit in May, and two were planned to be done this summer to be completed by October. The current plan is that, although originally planned to do all three on Unit 2, only one will be done on Unit 2, EDG 22, because that one is already completed, but the last two on Unit 2 governors will not be replaced. This was due to the cost overrun issue on the first four replacements. And as it was an obsolescence issue, the decision was made basically that once four of the six governors had been changed out, that material removed from the diesel generators with evaluation from engineering could be made available for spares for the remaining two diesel generators. So capturing the equipment removed through the replacements that are being done this year and evaluating those and setting them aside to be used if needed on the last two units was a decision to address the obsolescence issue. We asked specifically what if there was anything technically that would be missed by not making that replacement. And the system engineer reported to us that there would be a small improvement in governor response time that's obtained with the new governors, but that the old governors had an adequate response time, and that's demonstrated regularly through the use of load rejection testing on the diesel generators. That certainly is the best way to test the effectiveness of the governor, is to do a load response test where all the load is taken off the diesel generator and make sure the governor picks up the diesel generator appropriately and keeps it from overspeeding, and that the old governors have never had issue with that passing that test. So we felt comfortable that the old governors are adequate, even though the replacement of them have been canceled. Lastly, there was an issue on Unit 1 with one of the diesel generators has a slight oscillation in frequency, but that's the diesel generator that's being monitored. It hasn't exceeded specs yet. But that diesel generator is one that will have its governor replaced, and it's expected that will solve the problem. The other thing we asked about was the emergency diesel generator reliability plan. That's been a long-term plan to improve diesel generator reliability. And we were pleased to find that that plan has been closed. The goals have essentially been achieved. Those were to reduce the unavailability time, to reduce the number of component failures, and the number of EDG condition reports in the corrective action system. All those goals have been achieved, and EDG power reliability index is now at 100 points, and unavailability is less than 1%, specifically 0.92%. So in general, our conclusion was significant progress has been made by the station in dealing with longstanding issues on the emergency diesel generators, and this is a good progress for the station. Any questions before I go on? All right, next item on our list, the process control system. Again, a routine observation of system health meeting. And the process control system is a digital control system in the plant that serves various forms of various functions in the reactor coolant system primarily, such as controlling pressurizer level and pressure, charging water flow, volume control tank level, auxiliary feed water pump runout protection, similar functions. It has both safety-related and non-safety-related functions. And those two portions of the system, the safety-related, are kept isolated from the non-safety-related portions of the system. The systems on both units were all considered in green health. They were replaced in 2013 with a Triconic system. You probably remember that. Performance has been good with those replacement systems. There have been some minor card failures, graphics issues, diagnostic logging that are being addressed on the system. And the notifications were provided to us, and we reviewed those and agreed those were not major issues and that the appropriate corrective actions were in place.
Rick,
was the system was healthy with no outstanding major outstanding issues.
Rick, you didn't hear anything at all about any issues with the separation between the safety-related and non-safety-related parts of that system.
No, we did not.
I had remembered, this is years ago, when it was going in, that was a major concern because there had been some other plant somewhere, more than one, where they had installed it and those separations had been compromised inadvertently through the design, and there was a lot of attention paid at the time. But that's apparently not been the case here at all.
None of the issues that were reported to us had that characteristic. They're all generally independent, individual component failures in a system that has a great deal of redundancy, and the failures had very little impact on operations.
Yeah, I remembered all of that. Okay, thank you.
We then met with Station Director Carrie Harbor, discussed items from the visit, and then listened to in a conference call. It was a Plant Health Committee meeting. Plant Health Committee is a management committee that's responsible for reviewing system and program health issues on a regular basis. This was another meeting that was done by a conference call. Materials were distributed ahead of time to attendees, and as we participated in the meeting, the conference call format seemed to work fairly well. With our March meeting data point on the notification review team and the meeting data point here in May, I think in the larger picture, the committee's observations of remote meetings now being held that normally would be held in person appear to be being handled very well. And I think that's something we do need to keep getting ourselves involved in on our fact-finding meetings, is trying to listen in on meetings that used to be done in person are now being done remotely and see how they're going. And so far, so good for what we see, including this Plant Health Committee meeting. There were two specific system issues or systems that were reviewed by on a routine basis by the committee. In this case was the fire protection system. Program was generally healthy with problem areas being addressed. And actually, that system is coming up soon for review, and we'll probably take a look at it in August with our committee. And then the 4 kV electrical distribution system was reviewed, and specifically a couple of events that happened recently on that system. We're also talked through the status with the Plant Health Committee, and those were both issues that our committee has been previously involved in and reviewed. Our conclusion was the May 13th meeting, the Plant Health Committee was conducted effectively and efficiently. Next item on our agenda was review of the margin management program. Margin management is a program that's designed to monitor the design or operating margins that are present in systems, make sure that the margin does not come degraded over time and such that the plant finds itself all of a sudden outside of design margin into what we would call outside design basis areas. An example would be where there's a 10 degree margin on a system and something changes in the system to slowly erode that margin away, and then all of a sudden one day it's found that it's gone. The idea is to monitor margin and identify such trends ahead of time and avoid those kind of situations. The primary takeaway from our visit is that this program has recently been eliminated and replaced with what's now called the margin management process. That change was initiated by a Nuclear Energy Institute efficiency bulletin titled Eliminate Formal Margin Management Programs. And the bulletin, we obtained a copy and reviewed it, but it essentially said that these formal margin management programs that have been present in nuclear power plants for years, that the majority of functions in those programs could be performed by the other existing programs, such as the design control process, system health monitoring, corrective action program, et cetera. We reviewed the changes to the procedure and the process and felt that they were appropriate. There's still a process in that there's still an owner for the margin management now process who monitors issues at the station, identifies those that may be related to degrading margin on a system or a process. There's still a margin management review team that meets to review those issues if needed, and the plant still maintains a top margin issues list. So essentially some of the major features of the old program are still retained and used, but the bulk of the work has been transferred to the other, or taken credit for by the other programs that already cover it at the station. We took a look at what was on the list and what had been recently completed. There were several items that were previously on the margin issue list that had been resolved. Those items included containment fan cooling unit differential pressure issues. Several of those units have been replaced to solve that. Boric acid transfer pump differential pressure issues. Those pumps have been replaced. Containment leakage rate, alternate source turn implementation had resorbed some of the margin that had been eroded away on leakage rate limits. So those are some of the longstanding issues that have been tracked and resolved under the program. There are two open issues on the current top margin management issues list. The first we've already talked about over with the ASW system, that's the open ocean water temperature issue. And the other was an issue with the Aux building ventilation system charcoal filter test margin, which I'll talk about in my next slide. We concluded the process, the new margin management process was effective, and also recommended that we remove this as a program that's regularly reviewed by the committee. And we did that with the recent revision of the open items list. The next item on our agenda was a review of auxiliary building system health. The auxiliary building ventilation system serves to cool, heat, and filter air supplied to personnel and equipment in the auxiliary building. This is a typical ventilation system in that it keeps people warm and cool as needed, but it also supplies cooling in particular to a lot of safety-related equipment in the auxiliary building. So it's important in that regard in particular. It also filters in accident conditions in particular, exhaust from the auxiliary building such that if there's any leakage of radioactive gas out of the auxiliary building, it'll be captured by this system and filtered before it's released to the environment. So there's a couple of sets of charcoal filters in this system that are not normally in place. They're occasionally put in during normal operation, but are more typically reserved for emergency situations to be available to filter the exhaust if needed. This is a Tier 2 system. There's no formal health report, although all the deficiencies are still tracked, and there is a system engineer responsible for the system and who met with us and briefed us on the situation. In general, the health of the auxiliary building ventilation system is really only fair. It is improving, but there are many issues, and the most telling of that is that there, over the last 2 years, have been a significant number of maintenance rule functional failures. This is where failures have occurred on the system that affected the functions of it and are required to be monitored under the NRC's maintenance rule. There were specifically 3 issues on Unit 1 and 7 issues on Unit 2. 3 maintenance rule functional failures on Unit 1 and 7 on Unit 2 in the last 2 years. As such, the system was in A1 status which is the maintenance rule designation for a system that's had a high number of failures. Corrective actions are required to be put in place, and they have been put in place. And then the system's required to be monitored to ensure those corrective actions are effective before the system can be taken out of A1 status. And that is essentially the current situation with the system. Most of the maintenance rule functional failures involve dampers that failed during various situations. Cause evaluations were performed, and the cause was found to be an inadequate periodicity of maintenance. Specifically in 2015, the maintenance on those dampers, the periodicity was increased from 6 to 12 months. And in, a year later, in 2016, the damper started to fail. The station quickly recognized that they needed to move the maintenance back to 6-month interval to ensure that those dampers were reliable. Additionally, there were other maintenance activities initiated to overhaul various dampers, various other components in the system to improve reliability. There was quite a long list of actions that had been taken once it was recognized that the system was fairly degraded. So all those most of those actions are complete. There's a few left, but the majority are complete, and the system is in the monitoring status. Accordingly, we recommend again that this system be reviewed by the committee again in mid-2021, just to see that corrective actions have been effective, given the significance of the number of problems in this system. Problems that have now been fixed, but which are being monitored, that the fixes are effective going forward. Lastly, we talked about the issue I previously mentioned, the margin management program. This is an issue where Unit 2's charcoal filter, a batch or a sample was removed from one of the batches in that filter for routine testing required by technical specifications to see that charcoal would absorb the amount of gases that it's supposed to design to absorb. One batch failed the surveillance test, and that required that batch of charcoal in the filter to be replaced within 24 hours. And the station did successfully replace that filter batch of charcoal and return it to operable status. Reviews found that the charcoal was found to be able to, could degrade faster than the station had anticipated with the test interval. With a test interval and acceptance criteria for previous tests. They reviewed Unit 1 in particular to see the extent of condition and found that Unit 1 also had a low margin, meaning the previous test was only had a small amount of percentage margin before reaching the limit and might be at risk of failing if waited to the next surveillance test to be tested. So it was for Unit 1, that charcoal filter is now planned to be replaced, I believe, during the upcoming outage. And that's on the margin management list because it's recognized as having degraded margin and possibly could pass the next or fail the next surveillance test if not replaced as promptly as possible. So our conclusion, the system is in fair health, not good health, purposely there. And then we should review the corrective actions for the previous failures again about a year from now. Last item on our agenda was we reviewed the status of responding to the pandemic. I don't believe there's any new information in here that we haven't already discussed at length elsewhere in this meeting or in the training discussion I had earlier. So I won't restate all these things we've already talked about. That pretty much concludes my report. I'll answer any questions and request approval of the report.
Comments from the committees? Committees members?
I have to say, I think it's a brilliant report. Of course, I'm a co-author, so.
Yes, indeed. Exceptionally. <Sorry. awesome.
laughs> If anybody differs in their opinion, they can say so.
Rick, I read the report in draft, you know, as we all did. I was puzzled by how the Aux Building Ventilation System issues had strung out for such a long time. Because we reviewed that, I can't remember when, 2 or 3 years ago, and it looked like, I can't remember when, but you could find it. And it looked like there was a plan that was going to resolve it, you know, expeditiously, and then it just took a lot longer. Do you have any comment about that?
No, it's a good question. I mean, the timing was, give me one moment to make sure I got the dates right. So 2015, they did the maintenance interval change. 2016, the failure started to occur. Most of the corrective actions were done in the 2018 timeframe. That probably would have been right around the time of the team's last review. Actually, I have the date of the last review here.
I think it was about a couple of years ago.
Yeah, a couple of years ago. I am a little surprised. I haven't gone back and read the last report in detail, but I do feel with you, like you're saying, maybe we're a little late to this party, for lack of a better term, that we probably should have been concerned with this a little earlier.
Well, I wasn't going to argue that case. I was just wondering, not whether we're late to it, but I was wondering whether you had any, you talked to them. You had any sense from them about what and why? In other words, you know, was it, what did they change people, or did it lack a managerial sort of a high level oversight, or was there somebody wasn't doing it, or?
One second, let me call up another document. What I'm looking for is we have a list of all the corrective actions that have been done. And I can tell you some of the dates when, yeah, we have a list. We have the HP, the action plan for the Ox Building ventilation system.
Yeah. Well, let me describe. I'm sorry. In your fact-finding report, you said the last time we looked at it was in March of 2017, which was just 3 years before this look. And at that time, everything was okay. And then things started to fall apart thereafter.
That's correct. And specifically, the first damper failure that's in the large plan that we looked at was in September of 17. And then most of them occurred in 18.
Okay. I don't know what else to say about that, just to comment about it. Now, maybe we were, it's not us that's derelict, although maybe we should have looked at it in between more frequently than we had. But when that all happened in 18, whenever it was, it sure took them a long time to get on top of it all.
Well, they are. A lot of changes have been made, and they have to monitor for a fairly long period of time by the maintenance rule. So some of these things the issues are still open for issues that were corrected a year and a half ago, just because they have to go to 2 years for monitoring under the maintenance rule. But so somewhat drug out by the corrective action time period of the maintenance rule for evaluation. But your point's still a good one.
Okay, I don't need to dwell on that more. Thanks.
Mr. MacArthur.
Yes, sir.
Hello. You, as a Naval Academy graduate, Mr. MacArthur, you belong to a really pre-selected group of Naval officers in your early career. And as such, I would assume you are really familiar what the Navy in particular and the U.S. military in general among the best practices in confronting a pandemic. Now, are there any additional insights you'll be able to share with us vis-a-vis how the Able Cannon facility is coping with the pandemic?
From my Navy experience, no, because I don't think we knew how to spell pandemic 30 years ago. certainly wasn't the forefront of our thinking. I'll just say, since you brought it up on the aside, I have I have been seeing what the Naval Academy has been doing. And certainly they were in the news, all the service academies, how they were doing graduations. And currently they're in processing a new class of 1,000 midshipmen. So, and there's a lot of changes, but they do line up with, you know, you're asking me to be expectation, to speak this off the top of my head, but they are very similar to some of the things that Diablo Canyon is talking about, like for outage management. They're separating the students. The students, instead of reporting on board all 1,000 on one day, are now coming 200 at a day. In the processing, they're being kept separate, you know, and everybody's getting a COVID test. Everybody's being monitored for temperature, you know, so it's a very similar situation in that they've got a lot of people to process coming in. And it sounds very similar the way Diablo Canyon's handling.
Great. That's great insight. Thank you. Thank you. Additional comments from the committee? Mr. Waddell?
No, nothing.
Very okay. Good. Hearing none, let's move on to entertain public comments on our speaker's outstanding presentation. Mr. Rahi, do you see any hands raised electronically?
I am counting hands right now, Mr. Chairman, and the sum comes to zero at this time.
Okay.
There'd be no hands being raised.
So, okay. So the time is right for me to make a motion to accept the report, which, if it passes, means that it'll become a public document and it'll go into our annual report.
Before we had a second, may I remind everybody, Professor English, Dr. Professor Bob Butner said, reminded us the motion should be for acceptance of the report, but not
approval. I'm not a professor. I was never a professor.
Right. But we consider your expertise in editing to be outstanding, Dr. Butner. So let us entertain a motion for accepting the report. And Dr. Butters just moved one, right?
Yeah, I just want to point out to people that I have a Bachelor of Arts degree in college, not a Bachelor of Science.
Is that right? A BA?
Yes.
BA degree? Oh, okay. Okay. So we now have a motion by Dr. Butters for accepting the report, and I gladly second that motion. And let's take a vote. Let's take a vote. My vote is aye.
Aye.
So the motion carries, and I believe we, yes, Dr. Peterson?
Yep, I vote yes.
Oh, yes, okay. Now, I believe we are done with our business for the morning session.
Mm-hmm.
So let us adjourn the morning session and reconvene at 1 p.m.
So can I talk about the agenda for the afternoon? Because there was a change that Bob Rathy told us that when we started. You want to reiterate that change here, Bob?
Sure. For the presentation this afternoon, we have one presentation, which will be on the integrated risk assessment process, and that presentation will be made by Mr. Jeff Bryant.
Yeah, okay.
So instead of two presentations, we now have one.
That is correct. The presentation that was listed on your agenda as number 7 was given as the first presentation this morning by Mr. Peterson.
Yeah, I thought it was worth clarifying that here rather than not letting that let the public know.
Good point.
So we're coming back at 1 o'clock for that. We'll have, of course, public comment and so on. And that's the only presentation we have this afternoon. And then we have some committee business. So we'll be over earlier than normal.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. So if everybody is ready, let's adjourn our morning session.
Well, I have a request. Before we adjourn the morning session, since we have time, I have a request. We heard earlier in the morning about a presentation that Tom Jones gave at the engagement panel about a week ago. And I was just wanting to ask PG&E, probably Hector. You can find that and send it around to everybody. It's very helpful. I have it, but I'm not sure the others have it.
Right, I don't have it.
I agree.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes, perfect. The engagement panel meeting was a week ago today, I think. 24th, whenever that was. It'd be a week ago yesterday. And Jones gave a whole lot of detail about those issues about the spent fuel and, you know, that stuff. Okay.
Great, great.
Yeah, send it around to everybody, including me.
Okay. Any additional comments, business, before we adjourn?
And by the way, it is sufficiently important and valuable that I was thinking that we could put it on our website, but it's on their website and their public access too. So we don't have to, that would be redundant.
Good. Very good.
Okay. Thank you. Now let's adjourn and we convene at 1 o'clock.
1 o'clock. Very good.
Mute and stay on the website.
Webstream is live.
Thank you. The time is exactly 1 o'clock. And ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the second day afternoon session of the 96th public meeting of the Diego Cannon Independent Safety Committee. The first item on our agenda is for committee members' comments.
I have no comment.
Dr. Butner said no comments. Dr. Peterson?
Sorry, I need to mute. No.
Okay. Since there are no committee members' comments, let's move on to the next item on our agenda, which is for public comments on any matters of their own choosing. So any members of the public who wishes to address the committee on any matter that's important to them, please raise their hand electronically so that our counsel, Mr. Rahi, can move forward to allow the speakers to address the committee.
And Mr. Chairman, we do have Ms. Sherry Lewis, who has her hand raised, and I will go and unmute her on this side, and she should be able to talk here.
Thank you.
Let's see, test not available, is using an older version. It says that I cannot allow to talk, not available because Sherry is using an older version of Zoom.
There she is.
I'm helping out here.
Promote. Okay, you got her. Okay, thank you.
Ms. Lewis?
Yeah, very good.
Ms. Sherry? Lewis? Ms. Lewis, you're on.
She's probably got it on mute something.
No, it doesn't appear so.
I don't see a microphone icon. I'm not sure that she has that capability.
Oh. Sherry, I don't know if you can hear us. Does your device have a microphone? There's no way for you to tell us.
She spoke yesterday, didn't she?
She did.
Yes.
Could.
We have somebody calling her right now to try to figure this out.
Okay. Let's wait.
Sure.
I'm sorry. I was distracted.
Any success in contacting Miss Lewis?
Yes, Bob Lloyd is talking to her on the phone right now.
Okay, let's wait for her.
If worst comes to worst, she can call in, you know, just with a telephone.
Yes. Well,
so Pear, what are we looking at behind you there? Is that the bay?
Well, what Pear has is certainly not San Francisco Bay.
No, it's more like in the vicinity of the plant.
Yeah, it looks like a picture from the driving on the access road to the plant.
Yeah.
So it sounds like Sherry Lewis will be attempting to call in on her telephone. So give us a minute.
Sure.
I got a photo of the control room at the plant. I was going to put myself in there for the meeting, but I decided not to do that. Also, the turbine building.
Yeah. That photoshopping technology is dangerous.
Well, if you're going to the plant, you need to be wearing your mask. So remember that. So if I see you in the control room, I expect to see you with a mask on.
If I'm there, I'll have a mask. Believe me.
All right.
I need an escort, though.
True enough.
So Tom or Hector, Hossein has not been with us this meeting or the previous one, I think. Is he still?
He moved on to STARS. So that's why Russ Prentice presented that today.
Is he still with PG&E? But he,
yes. STARS? Yeah, so the way STARS works is it's got a number of people holding positions that are on loan from the participating utilities. So Hossein is still a PG&E employee, but he's basically the functional area manager for the regulatory STARS group. So, mm-hmm. You know, back when I was running reg services, just like Hossein was, we would participate in weekly phone calls, collaborate with the other regulatory services managers, and support each other. When issues or challenges might come up.
Sherry Lewis has now called in.
Ms. Lewis?
Yes, you can hear me now, I guess.
Yes.
Okay, sorry for the problem. Okay, I have a couple of questions based on all that has gone on. I reread my notes, and just a couple of minor things. One of them is when you have the array of assemblies, and you do one hot surrounded by four cold. When I picture that, I realize that's actually just one cold between two hots, if you just keep doing that. Can the four colds surrounding one hot be part of the colds that are surrounding the next one?
Yes, it's like a checkerboard.
Right. Yes. So it would be every other square in one direction
If you took a checkerboard, if you took a checkerboard and put the hot ones in, put the cold ones, you can see how that is.
Right. Okay. My other one is I never heard the answer yesterday to the idea of replacing cold assemblies with dummies. Do you understand what I'm saying?
There was a response to that. If you take a cold fuel element out of there and stick in a piece of metal, that metal is going to become radioactive. That metal is going to become radioactive because it's exposed to a whole lot of radioactive gamma rays and so on from the nearby elements, and that becomes an additional bunch of radioactive waste. Now it's not high level.
Well, but the cold one is already radioactive.
That's right. But if you take a cold one out and you put in a piece of metal, you're making additional waste that wasn't there if you just had the cold one. See, because that
well additional waste, but it won't be bloody hot though.
No, that's right. It's not high level waste. It'd be low level waste, or it might be intermediate, depending on how long it's in there and how long the exposure is. That's correct.
Okay. Well, that's it. Thank you. Thank you very much for answering the question.
So does that clarify that? So the question about whether you want to do that is not simply a thermal management of the fuel or whatever. It has to do with, okay, you've got this additional stuff, and if you're doing it, it could be hundreds of those things. Then there's a whole lot of waste to cope with. And the judgment was that's certainly a downside of that scheme.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Stay on.
I understand what you're saying, yeah.
Anybody else have a comment about that? Do you want to add? Anybody else?
Thank you, Ms. Lewis.
Thank you. Okay. Bye.
Thank you.
Now, the next item on our agenda is for informational presentation requested of PG&E by the committee. May I now turn the electronic podium to Mr. Tom Boren, the Director of Generation Business Planning. Mr. Boren.
Thank you, Dr. Lamb. So we're going to be talking about the integrated risk assessment process that we use at Diablo Canyon and applying that process to our work planning efforts. We've got Jeff Bryant with us today. Jeff is the Assistant Director of Nuclear Maintenance and Planning. He's been at Diablo Canyon for 10 years, and he started on site as the Site Manager for Fluor Power Services. He joined us in 2016 as an outage in our outage management department and has since moved on into the greater role of our Assistant Director of Maintenance and Planning. His entire career has been focused on industrial construction and maintenance with a consistent focus on safety and process improvement. Jeff, turn it over to you.
Thank you, Tom, and good afternoon to everyone else on the committee and on the phone. So as Tom mentioned, today we're going to be discussing, or I'm going to be discussing our integrated risk assessment process. So I'm completely on the phone, so I apologize, I'm flying blind a little bit here. So I'll be starting on slide 2. So the purpose of our program provides a systematic approach to identifying and addressing each risk exposure, ensuring that all areas are addressed in a timely and appropriate manner. This allows us to have a conservative decision-making process that supports our overall safety plan of the station. So this is needed because maintenance, testing, every time we touch the plant could potentially result in changes to the baseline risk that has already been decided and part of our license basis evaluations of the power plant. This really is an opportunity for us to calculate, quantify, and mitigate any potential impacts we may incur on the station. So next slide, please. So high-level summary of the process, it's a step program. The first step is identifying any potential risks. the next step is assessing risks. Let me put a pause there. We will go into further detail of this stuff later. The third is preventing and mitigating the risk, and then implement risk management strategies. And then our most important part is learning and adapting once we've implemented and completed the work to validate if we had any opportunities. Next slide, please. So the areas of risk, there's quite a few of them that we focus on here. As always, everything we do at Diablo Canyon and Pacific Gas and Electric is focused on safety. Industrial safety is what can hurt the people that are at the plant, physically doing the work. The nuclear safety is what can hurt the plant as we manipulate any of the equipment here. The radiological safety is the impact of the community around us, which is extremely important. Chemistry and environmental safety is very similar. That's any impact to station or public by the manipulation of our activities. And then regulatory compliance and plant operation, which is the guidance provided by the NRC and our other regulators. And then, of course, a key important part of our program here is security to make sure that we don't impact them, which also challenges the plant public safety as well. Next slide, please. So the Integrated Risk Review Team is a collaboration of many key contributors and subject matter experts. Operations is always included. This is always a senior reactor operator, depending on which system we touch, is depending which senior reactor operator we get from which department. Maintenance is also always included as the activity performers. Radiation protection and chemistry and environmental, even though we may not be touching any aspects of their systems, we routinely bring them into the meetings as subject matter experts and as a third-party peer review to provide one extra level of validation of our plan. We always pull in the safety and security departments. Same thing, if anything that we could do would affect any of the three safety categories, safety can provide the guidance and industry OE to keep us in line there. And then security, in the event we had any unintended consequences, we would not negatively impact their programs or processes. Engineering is always a part of it, again, as a key contributor and subject matter expert on the systems that we would be manipulating. Emergency planning to ensure that they are prepared in the event of an unintended consequence so we don't impact them. And then planning and work control, which is also a portion of maintenance. It's a separate arm. Planning obviously develops the work packages, and work control develops the risk mitigation plans. Next slide, please.
Yeah, Jeff, leave that slide up just for a minute. No, okay. Go back. No, this is just humorous, but notice how those four people are socially distancing.
Well, I mean, you can't see the mask, but I promise you they're there.
It's a pre coronavirus logo.
They are wearing masks, I promise you.
Oh, they're all wearing masks. Okay.
And Jeff, another question. I don't see the PRA people on this slide. Do they participate?
So the PRA don't participate in the actual review meetings. We will bring them in third party, but they're not a required part of the process. If we do work that is regulatory challenging, then we will bring them in, but not part of the formal everyday process.
Okay.
Okay. Or any other questions on that slide? Okay, so we should be on page six.
Yeah.
Is there a question?
No.
Okay. So this is the T-week process for identifying potential risks. So we have a T28 work week window process that we go through. We start identifying our work scope at T28. Once we get to T7, the expectation is all risk has been identified for every activity, from low all the way to very high risk. And we begin the process, there as far as our risk review meetings with, the key members on the previous slide. any work that's added to the plant schedule between T7 and T8, we have an additional process to do a deeper dive. This requires scope addition approval, depending on the department, from a different level of people. So we're not just dropping things into the schedule around the risk review process. It does get an additional check because it didn't additionally follow the process. And then at T3, which is the third bullet, the clearance tagout risk, between weeks T4 and weeks T3, so T minus four, this is when operations, the scheduled crew for operations validates the schedule, they validate the risk, and they provide the final operational evaluation of the risk to ensure that the maintenance or testing is not impacting any operational considerations, whether it be emergent plant status or proposed plant status or any grid conditions that would limit permissions of performing the work. Next slide, please.
Okay, thank you. Jeff, just a quick comment for the team on the phone and everyone. Their awareness that when you see T minus seven, it actually means 7 weeks prior to performing the work. So when you heard Jeff talking about T minus 28 all the way to T3, it's 3 weeks prior to doing the work.
Thank you for the clarification. Yep, thank you for clarifying that for me.
You're welcome, Jeff. I'm on slide seven.
Okay. So these are the four risk levels that the program provides guidance for. These are just bullets. We will get into definitions on the further slides. So it's low risk, medium risk, high risk, and then very high risk. Next slide, please. So the prevention and mitigation strategies by risk. So the first is the most common. Majority of our work is low risk here. There are no additional mitigations required. The workers and their supervisors will self-brief on the risk. The process in place here is really following our site standards, the work instructions or procedural guidance that they have in place. Our site standards handbook provides the two-minute rule and the pre-job brief evaluation. So with the scope review that's performed by the crews, they can validate how they are going to impact either themselves, the plant, or the public. And then it can make appropriate localized mitigations for that.
So I've got a simple question. I know the answer, but I just want to clarify. These four risk levels, it could be risk to the worker, or it could be what we call safety, which is the big accident that would be risk to the public, right? Either of those could elevate the category, right?
That is correct. That is correct. So for example, and as I go through, I'll provide examples to add some clarity. So low risk is changing a fluorescent lamp in a hallway of the turbine building, not near any significant piece of equipment. So that puts it in context on the mitigations that we would have to put in place. Moving to the next bullet. So medium risk, this is not too much different than low risk. We really don't have a lot of medium risk. What would consider something medium risk is an increase in personal safety challenges, so industrial safety. So this is a review of the work documents for any plea planning or mitigating actions. This is typically work that is a little more than just through a work package or written work instructions. These have procedural guidance through our written procedures that we have. So routine activities that we've identified higher than low risk. So we've proceduralized it and provide the guidance that way instead of work orders that are modified each time. So the same mitigating actions are in place. The use of our site standards handbook with the pre-job brief and the two-minute rule, and then the use of the procedural guidance plus the work order. Next slide, please. So moving on to high risk. So the prevention and mitigation here, review the work documents for any of the required pre-planning and mitigation actions. We do complete a risk management plan. We include that risk management plan in all work documents. As always, the workers are briefed on their risk in the pre-job brief. And then we hold a post-job critique after the work is complete for lessons learned. So one of the key aspects for high risk and very high risk is we do a risk challenge board. So this is a board composed of directors, operations, key stakeholders. Typically, maintenance and planning are involved in that because we do a majority of the work there. The goal of that board is ensuring the plan will allow for successful completion of the elevator work activity. So what we do is the procedural guidance for the integrated risk. We have a template. It's prevention, detection, and correction. And the work group that's performing the work or the testing has to complete that prior to coming to the risk challenge board. The prevention is the mitigating actions or eliminating actions of any risk that would be incurred during the activity. The detection section of that template is an unintended or unanticipated action or consequence and what our actions are there. So for example, if we opened up an electrical cabinet and there was something unexpected inside of there, maybe a lamacoid had fell off from the inside of the door and was leaning on wires, that would be the detection portion of it. And the correction portion of that template is what actions we would take if we had a direction. So keeping the same example, we would be putting our work in a safe condition. We would contact the control room. We would contact the supervisor and begin the evaluation process there on how we can safely back out. So that the PDCs, as we call them, the prevention, detection, correction, are required for all high risk and very high risk work and the risk challenge board.
Jeff, as you put things in these categories, do you quantify them numerically somehow or by color to determine your risk category?
No, they are all on any schedule or any scheduling document or plan of the day or plan of the next day package. They are listed by their risk level, not numbers. So low, medium, high, or very high. To be honest, there's too many numbers on all of our documents. We want the words to be present so they really catch someone's eye.
Okay, thanks.
And moving to the very high risk, similar to the high risk with the addition of perform contingency planning. So the very high risk activities are also occasionally considered infrequently performed tasks or evolutions. So an example there is during a refueling outage, lifting our reactor head is an infrequently performed task. So that goes through an additional risk challenge board with a contingency plan. We also implement a manager and direct oversight sponsor for each of our very high risk activities. They are in the field or as safely local as possible to ensure that we have that subject matter expert and managerial oversight to be able to coach and apply corrective actions as needed on the fly. If there are no questions on that slide, next, please.
Jeff, this is Rick McWhorter. How often do you get the high and very high risk activities when the unit is online? How often do they typically occur?
When the unit is online, very high risk is very infrequent. Thinking of this year, so year to date, I think we've had two very high risk activities, and they were both associated with our rod control system. So the very high risk are rare, and there's a lot of contingency planning put involved with that. The high risk is a little more frequent. I will say once about every 2 weeks, we'll have a high risk activity on our schedule again, typically revolving around nuclear safety, occasionally with industrial safety due to the confined space work that we do here quite frequently.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. And should be on slide 10, Hector?
That's correct.
Okay. So the implementation of the risk management strategies, the primary sponsor is the work group supervisor. The workers have a key role in that as well, since they're the ones that are going to be performing the work. So we ensure they review the risk level and the mitigation actions during the pre-job brief. So this is typically the first meeting in the morning that the supervisors and craft have together. They ensure that all the work documentation has the right risk level documented. They include a summary, a list of all the high and very high risk activities scheduled the next 24 hours. So if you recall earlier, I talked about our plan of the day and plan of the next day work packages. We have an integrated risk section that our senior reactor operator, our shift manager on duty, will discuss if we have any. And then we also have an integrated risk a section in there where we talk about our medium and high in the other areas, with the expectation that the work group responsible, you know, performs a report out on the plan, the mitigating actions, and then who the single point of contact is. So the large percentage or large population of the members on the call know who to contact if there's any challenges there. And then the last bullet point, so this just provides one more step of guidance. You know, before starting work, the team verifies that conditions have not changed sufficiently to make sure that the risk assessment is adequate. So this is, again, following our site standards handbook. If you've been out here before, it's the last page on there. So we have high visibility of it. This is the 2-minute rule. This forces the crew to validate that there are no changes in the field once they've arrived, and they can ensure that any mitigating actions part of the plan have been implemented and are not impacted by any unexpected changes once they arrive to the job site. Next slide, please. And then the most important after we perform the work is learning and adapting. For low and medium risk activities, we document any risk challenge or learnings in the work order completion remarks. And then these are stored in our RMS program so we can refer back to them if we have similar work activities in the future. We conduct a post-job critique, the completion of high or very high risk evolutions. This is procedurally required for every activity we perform at that risk level. And then as part of our T+1 meeting, so this is post work, we review, again, our high and very high risk evolutions with a different party of people, again, to ensure that we don't have any challenges there. The ultimate goal of this final step is to identify the successes and opportunities so we can continue to learn and grow as an organization. And that is the end of my presentation, unless there are any questions.
Comments from the committee members?
So, Jeff, the first line workers, do they understand the concept reasonably well?
Yes, they do. That is one of the reasons. So speaking specifically for high and very high, we bring the first line supervisors and craft into those meetings, not only so they can see the process and see, you know, how we're providing mitigations and protections for them, the station, and the public, but it also allows them as a subject matter experts to weigh in on possibly a better way to do something that may mitigate the risk, you know, or eliminate the risk completely. So they are always included in the risk discussion.
Now, I know you've had a application called Phoenix, or maybe now Safety Monitor, that you've used to make some risk determinations for taking components out of service. Is that used regularly in this integrated process?
That is. So that's part of our work control process. That provides our PRA, and I'm sorry, hopefully Tom can remind me what that stands for. I don't want to give an acronym over the phone.
That's probabilistic risk assessment, and that's our online risk monitoring tool. As Jeff said, we use that for assessing our total. It's part of our work planning process where we look at the total work week risk, and we look at that day by day, job by job as we've planned them. And it is actually also an entry point for elevating the risk significance of a job if it were something that would cause, for example, our online risk metric to go yellow. And so numerical PRA does have an element in this process. We have also classified all of our components with respect to risk significance in terms of the risk achievement worth. And those higher risk components are particularly identified. If we plan a job against one of those high risk components, it does get flagged and can accordingly get escalated in this risk process to a high or very high risk. So, and that's all well laid out in our procedures as well.
Very good. Thank you.
Additional comments from the committee?
Yeah, this is Bob Buttis. I had remembered seeing one of these outage management plans for it was plant was running, so it was in service. They were taking something out of service, and the warning was if they could do it in 8 hours, it was not a problem. So they had a schedule that was going to do it in 4 or 6 or something like that. And then they were on notice that if it went over that, they had to do something to call in somebody to take some mitigating action. So it was sort of a contingency against the schedule delay. And that strategy was based on something that the PRA told them about how long that item could be out of service and still not have an elevated risk. And I imagine that that's the sort of thing that you would do. You call up the PRA group and ask them to analyze this a different off-normal configuration than the normal one and tell everybody whether the enhanced risk is very low or whatever it is. Right.
That is correct. And part of the process, depending on the piece of equipment and the vital nature of it, typically a short technical specification piece of equipment, once we reach 50% threshold of the scheduled time, that's where the mitigating actions come into play. The primary mitigating action for most of them is the activation of our outage command center, which puts key directors and managers in place so we can ensure that there are no challenges to the scheduled work and can provide additional oversight as required.
Understand. Can you tell us whether this approach is widespread in the other plants in the U.S.?
I am not able to. I'm going to ask for Tom's help on that. It's outside of my department responsibilities.
And I know that when we initially drafted this process a number of years ago, we did have processes from other plants that we used as inputs to develop ours. I cannot say how widespread it is, whether this is something that exists at every station at this point, or this is half of the industry. It is definitely in use in the industry. And again, I'm not in the work planning organization either, but as you know, good practices tend to spread rapidly with our open environment in the nuclear industry where we share best practices. Things like this do spread rapidly because ultimately it allows all of us to be prepared such that when unforeseen challenges do occur, we've got mitigations and actions in place that keep us safe. So,
and this is definitely a good practice.
Absolutely.
I remember either Furman or Rick is going to chime in as to which one was with me. One of you two guys was with me. We were on a fact finding. We went to one of these risk challenge board meetings. year and a half ago. Does one of you remember? I just
That was Rick.
It was. I don't remember. Sorry.
I think it was Rick.
Okay, he can chime in maybe, but in any event, and the people in the meeting were appropriately challenging or asking questions of the team who there are two groups there. One was the team going to do the work. The other one was whoever had done the analysis.
Actually, Bob, that was me and you, and it was done in a plant health committee meeting, if I recall, where transmission was there.
Thank you. That's right.
The insulators. Right. They had a new method for doing that or something. That's and right. They did a risk count.
That's right. It was a plant health committee meeting, but the logic was the same. Someone was doing the work, planning to. Someone was analyzing its risk importance, and they were reviewing it to make sure that they hadn't overlooked something before they were going to embark on this thing, because it had a relatively higher risk profile.
It did, and it was very pretty intrusive as well, I thought.
Yeah. That's what I remember.
Well, I believe I and Dr. Bunnis, I believe I may have participated in one of the risk challenge board discussions. And at that time, my impression was this is a good practice.
Well, let's concur.
Yeah. I don't know about the intrusive nature of it, as Mr. Wardell was referring to. You know, to me, the more intrusive it is, the better it would be.
Right. Yep. Tough questions.
Right.
Oh, I remember what they were doing. Out in the yard, just north of the main office building, are those transformers, and they were going to wash them. Remember that, Furman? And that was considered worthy of this sort of analysis.
They were washing the insulators.
Yeah, right.
500 kV lines. Yeah,
it was the 500 kV. Was it? I think it was the transformers, or was it the five? That's right. It was the 500 kV insulators. That's right. Thank you. We wrote that up in a fact finding year and a half ago. I can't remember.
We did. We certainly did. No more questions here.
Additional remarks from the committee?
No.
Okay, there being none, let's entertain public comments on our speaker's excellent presentation. Mr. Rahi, our counsel, do we have?
I see no hands raised, Mr. Chairman, at this point.
All right, let me send out one more invitation to members of the public who may be watching this proceeding. If you had comments on our speaker's presentation, please raise your hand so that the committee's counsel can activate your speakerphone. There being no response, it's time for us to move to the last item on our agenda, which includes some scheduling activity I believe we had taken care of. Am I correct, Council?
Yes, sir, you are correct. I believe we've done all the scheduling. I don't think that there were any changes. A couple of notations on the fact-finding public meeting list that was provided, and certain fact findings were scheduled, and a public meeting for October of 2021 was scheduled for the 19th and 20th. And just confirming that our next public meeting, which is very likely to be held via Zoom, is going to be on October 22nd and 23rd. That's a Thursday and a Friday. And we will develop an agenda that includes the PG&E informational presentations for Thursday, the 22nd of October.
So I have a question about that period, because we heard Matt Coward earlier in the meeting talking about that outage. The outage will be that it'll be 2 weeks into the outage, in the third week of the outage, when we hold that public meeting. And my schedule for the outage shows October 4th, And he confirmed that that was when it was supposed to start. But he mentioned this being a 30-day outage. But the schedule I've got shows that it's goes on for, I don't know, 39 days. I'm just wondering whether whether you guys know what when the current plan is for the end of the outage. And the reason I'm asking is because on November 9th and 10th, I'm due back there at a fact-finding with Rick McWhorter. And that is either just after the outage has ended or it's just when it's ending. And I'm wondering whether whether you know which of those it is.
Yeah, I could answer that, Dr. Budnitz. Either way, we'll be able to support you for the fact-finding. As you're aware, we always look at our schedule and try to optimize it as best we can. Our current schedule does show 39 days, but as you know, we always look for ways to optimize it.
Oh, I had no complaint about that. I figured that when we're there on November 9th and 10th, the current schedule shows you just be, you know, just coming out of the outage. Probably you're just, you know, starting to go through the modes and work your way up. Okay.
Okay. Are there any remaining matters need to be addressed before we go to concluding remarks by committee members?
Yeah, I just wondered whether Hector was able to confirm any of the dates that we newly established yesterday, or maybe that's too soon for that.
Yeah, I'll get back to the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee. On my off time, I was actually doing my work, so I'll have to get back to you on that.
Thank you.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a couple of questions for the committee on the October meeting. I've kind of been looking at topics for the meeting and appreciate any input you have. And of course, we'll have a chance to talk about that by email in a couple of months. But we have the last few years in October had a decommissioning update. I believe Philippe did the last one. I expect he might do this one if we ask for it. I was thinking that that might be a good time to do a decommissioning update, as well as we could get an update, whatever is the status at that point in the RFP process from that same group. And that could kind of be paired with the committee's discussion on the spent fuel risk study and recommendations possibly going forward from that in the evening session in October. How does that sound to the committee?
Certainly agree. What about Dr. Peterson and Dr. Butness?
Yes, that's a fantastic idea. Those are great topics to couple together and cover if we can get support from BG&E.
Well, it's going to be one of the topics that the public has remained with keen interest, and good for them.
Right.
By the way, there's another thing. Yesterday, when we were planning our future schedule, we learned that the engagement panel was going to be meeting in the evening of right in the middle of our 2-day fact finding then. And so we're going to try to take advantage of that. Okay. That would be November, I'm trying to remember, 9th or something like
September
that.
September 9th.
Oh, I'm sorry, September 9th, is it? Yeah, I think.
Correct.
Okay, and the other things that I have for October is the usual state of the plant update for NRC report, probably an update on coronavirus. We can decide that as it gets closer.
Almost sure.
We will have the presentation that was deferred this time on the cause and corrective actions on the rod control system. Those are the topics I have so far. If you have any more thoughts or comments, I'd take now, or we can just do that in a couple of months as it gets closer.
Just a comment, Mr. McWhorter, as always during public meetings, we usually do the regulatory presentation as well.
Right. Okay. I did kind of said NRC in a hurry there, but that was the idea. I understand. We will.
Well, but it could be that it'll be ripe for a report from Philippe Sunen again about the casks and the schedule and the RFP and the decision, but that depends. It's just in that period in October when that's going to be coming to a head.
So I was thinking we could ask him to just provide the latest status as part of the decommissioning update.
Yeah.
Because it would come out of that same group.
Yes. Yes.
Which conveniently is also a group that's not involved in the outage.
That's right.
That's all I have, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I've got two items, if I may. One is Dr. Peterson and I have our fact-finding meeting coming up on July 21 and 22. I put a proposed agenda in the green sheets, the FFPM, in our packet, rainbow packet, but I'll fine-tune that. And Hector, I'll send that to you in a day or two. You'll have that hopefully in plenty of time. Pear's already had one look at it, so I think we're generally okay on what we're going to do there. I assume that'll be a Zoom meeting or a WebEx meeting, so we'll plan on that. The next item would be our annual report, which is in process. I've sent out a schedule and an outline and responsibilities to everyone a few weeks ago. And just remind everyone that the first drafts are due to me August the 28th. You got about 2 months. And Hector, if you would, we'd appreciate you guys giving us a draft of that Appendix C.
Yes, absolutely.
I'll shoot you an email on that and provide last year's copy so you'll have it as a guide.
Definitely.
That's it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
In that regard, is your July fact-finding, which is just 3 weeks hence, 22-23, or is it 21-22?
Let me look real quick here. I think it's 21-22.
Okay, so the reason I'm asking is that on my schedule here, there's under emergency preparedness, there's an Alpha Team dress rehearsal on the 22nd. And I'm wondering whether sitting in on that would be, and I assume they're going to do that, even though Mike Jin said that they're going to do it remotely, whether perhaps sitting in on that would be worthwhile as part of your thing, even though it's sort of depending on the schedule.
I thought that was the one that he had a different date for.
Yeah, so I couldn't remember whether that was one of the ones that got moved.
You might just check on it, Vermin, see what
the... Yeah, because you remember the point of it was July 22nd because 4 weeks later was the evaluated exercise with that same Alpha Team being and so that was the point of that was to press rehearsal for that. Well, maybe with the evaluated exercise being put off, perhaps that's different.
Well, let me also take this opportunity to indicate that Mr. Furman Wardell has been responsible for putting together the committee's annual report. So if you see anything you'd like, the credit is due to Mr. Wardell. If you do not like that report, the blame is on the committee.
Oh, I like that. That's good. That's good. Okay. Very astute, Chairman. It's a good thing we elected you chairman. I tell you, you deserved it.
I refuse to take responsibility for that by myself.
Hector, would you check on that that July 22nd dress rehearsal and let me know?
Yeah, I'll get back to you on the July 22nd dress rehearsal status.
I'm going to go ahead and include it on our proposed agenda, and we can talk about it. Okay, good point.
I mean, for all we know, it may or may not even be or be put off or something. You'll find out.
Right, we'll find out. Okay, that's all.
All right, and then finally, you remember that Rick and I are going to sit in on the fourth day of the NSOC on November 19th, even though it's a week after our actual fact-finding thing. We're gonna tack that on.
Now, would you, Dr. Bundes, clarify for the members of the public, what is the rules of engagement between the committee and the NSOC meetings?
Yeah, I'll try to. The Nuclear Safety Oversight Committee is a committee of experts that is appointed by PG&E and reports to PG&E. They come two or three times a year for 4 days and do an in-depth review of a whole lot of safety issues that are not very different from our scope, actually. Although they have different approaches to it, and the way this works is on the fourth of their 4 days, they do a report out to the senior management, and we have been privileged to be able to be invited to those over the years when we're on site, and I've gone to some of them, and the others probably have too. And the rules of engagement for that are that that's confidential to the utility, so we are not. We learn from it, and it's helpful. but we're not in a position to say anything about it outside of our own inner circle here. Okay. Because they say things candidly to the utility that are that are because they're candid, like in poets in a way, they're not in the public domain.
So what you're saying is, Dr. Bendis, any information you gather from your participation as being invited to their meeting would not be disclosed or discussed in our committee's public meeting.
That's fair, although you understand why it's important. Perhaps they find a new issue that we didn't know about, or a new interpretation or a different perspective on it. Or much more commonly, they find something that confirms exactly what we also found, and that gives us extra confidence.
But would you be able to bring to the committee's attention in our public meeting about the issue without disclosing the sources?
No.
Okay.
No, that's fair. The understanding is that no. On the other hand, if we know something that gives us confidence, it gives us confidence, you know.
Right? Okay, that's fair.
By the way, our interaction with the INPO reviews is of the same character.
Yes, indeed. You know, because, you know, I had been invited on many occasions to participate in the Able Canon facilities, internal meetings. You know, when I and one of our technical consultants at 10, as an invitees, I always follow and disclose the rules that I follow, which is we were privileged to be invited, but we will not speak unless we are spoken to. And also we would certainly follow any confidential information safeguards when necessary. Yeah. So this is similar to what you are saying. Okay, I guess we are now ready to go to our last item on our agenda, which is for concluding remarks by committee members. Unless, Council, you got additional remarks. Council, do you have any additional remarks?
Yeah, I have an observation. I thought that considering the obvious limitations of working this way, that this Zoom approach has been remarkably effective in the context of those limitations. That is, there wasn't any particularly other glitches of importance. And I at least want to congratulate AGP Video on what they did to make this happen. And also the staff, we're talking about Hector and Tom particularly, but others too. I thought it worked pretty well. Others confirm that?
I'd like to share that with AGP Video and also with Hector and Tom. I appreciate all the cooperation and all the back and forth we had trying to set this up and getting on the same page, but I think it worked very well. And thanks especially to Bob Lloyd for his efforts on AGP's behalf, and Travis here today helping us with each session.
Thank you very much.
And Dr. Peterson?
I agree with everything that's been said. This has worked remarkably well. And it's been a very productive public meeting. I've enjoyed it, and we've learned a lot. I think we've done a good job here, and I also really appreciate all of the effort that PG&E has put into this, and AGP as well, and of course our wonderful consultants and council. So, thank you, everybody.
Well, I can only echo the sentiment of both committee members, Dr. Peterson and Dr. Butness, and on behalf of the committee, express our appreciation to PG&E senior managers, Director Tom Bowman, Manager Hector Garcia, for their help and participation, and express the committee's appreciation to members of the public who attend our public meeting remotely. And by that, I would like to adjourn the 96th public meeting of the Able Canon Independent Safety Committee.
Good. And just one last thought. Have a safe and sane 4th of July in good health.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Dr. Butness, and thank you, everyone.